I was requesting that in the interim that you don't waste time, and since AG is here, who is our strategic partner. AG, I was speaking with the auditors last week, internal auditors, and I said in the narrative that one is polygamous, the principal wife of Scopa would be AG, and everybody else would be wife number two and three. So I'm told that appropriation says they will only be here at 1:30. So I was requesting, AG, since you're here and this will be helpful for us, is that we've got our first oversight next week, AG. We're going to Usile and Medupi on Tuesday and Wednesday. And on Thursday, we're meeting with ESCOM, the board and the management. So we will be finalizing our briefing notes and so on. I just wanted if the administration, if can take us through briefly the program, so AG also has it, of what and when we'll be doing next week. And then maybe AG for us to introduce ourselves, so when appropriations comes here, we don't have to start with those introductions and so on. So I'm trying to find our, here's my program for oversight. Okay, here it is. And then Dungesa, please raise your hand because I don't think we've formally introduced you. You arrived, you met us halfway, ne? Yeah. That is who committee assistant will be colleagues coordinating all the travel arrangements, particularly as we leave. So AG, we will be on Monday, we're in Pretoria, we are in the evening, and we'll be receiving a report and a briefing on the two power stations on the state of projects in the evening on the two, so we've got an idea of what we're going into. And then on Tuesday, we're off to Lephalale, to the Medupi power station, and we return back to Pretoria. On Wednesday, we're going to Usile in Witbank, and then we return to Sentin. And then we will be meeting with the board at 9 o'clock on Thursday next week. So that's our program. I'm sure it has been circulated. Lungisa, please make sure members have all got your number. You get their details correctly, capture everything, and then finalize everything. So as we wait, we will start with introductions, AG, so you know who we are as the new team. The whole family is not here, but the majority of the family is here, so we'll do my introductions of everyone.
Yeah, I think I've introduced myself already to the AG at the last meeting. We had a meeting, I think, in New Wing.
The AG was not in that day.
Oh, she wasn't in that day. Okay. Okay, my name is Mervyn Dux, and I'm the ANC whip for Scopa. Thank you.
My name is Bernice Swartz, member of the Scopa committee.
Peggy Hadebe, member of the committee.
Afternoon, I'm Sakumzi Somyo, the member of the committee.
And I'm Kula Watengwa, the chair. I'm sure the colleagues you already know, our administration, you've been interacting with them in the previous life of this committee. So if AG or team can introduce themselves, I just want to, when appropriations come, I want us to dive into the work immediately.
I'm Fezeka Baleso, from the Auditor General.
Good afternoon, Chair and members. I'm Marissa Visaynout. I'm a business executive responsible for legal services in the AG's office.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Linda LaRue, also a business executive, and I'm responsible for our audit research and development and the general report.
Good afternoon. My name is Pena Ramwedzisi.
Good afternoon, Chair and honourable members. My name is Alice Miller. I'm acting national leader responsible for audit.
AG.
My name is Kimi Makwetu, Auditor General, and I know that Feza Kabali so said she comes from me. When she was introducing herself, I don't know whether it was deliberate. She said, I'm from Auditor General. That she says she comes from me.
I've recognized, AG, that the other temptation is not temptation per se, but we always say we're meeting with the AG, and then people expect the AG, and we are referring to the institution. I must say, as part of Women's Month, it's good to see the delegation of AG, that the AG Iyaqhuba. So what we will do, AG, is that we have divided the sessions of the workshop for different session chairs. So I will move aside, and Bab Samuel is chairing our session that you will be taking us through. So I hope that immediately when UAG, appropriations arrives, we will just dive into it. We would be done had we not waited, but I think in the spirit of cooperation, we are patiently waiting. So as soon as we start, Bab Samuel will take us through as chairing Vene. He is also the chair of AG. So it's only appropriate that happens. So, Koizif, we can just please put pressure on appropriation. I trust your astuteness. Okay, so I will... Oh, no, Bab Samuel. AG, Bab Samuel reminds me, your team briefed us on your municipal audit outcomes, and we were very concerned. You are on time, Mam Peters. You are the first one on time. I'm sure your team will be here shortly. AG, we prioritize the 13 municipalities that have got the that disclaimed adverse audit outcomes for 3 to 5 years that we had requested. We have scheduled those municipalities. We've also written to COCTA about them. There was the 48 that needed interventions, as you said, but there was that 13 which was of interest to us because of their age analysis and historic audit outcomes. So those have been scheduled for over 2 days. I'm sure we'll communicate the dates by the end of today. We've scheduled those. So we would like to get a briefing for each one of the 13 so that we can allocate to members in preparation for that hearing so they can lead the different hearings. So what we did is in the program is we've clustered them per province. So Free State ones will arrive in one slot, and then we'll start with A and B, Northern Cape, Northwest. Yeah, there's four. They're from four provinces. So we have clustered them like that, and then we're hopeful that we've not received any
disquiet about it, so we are expecting them. We'll be doing a follow-up. So those 13 municipalities, so maybe a comprehensive briefing for all of them, so that we can be able to sort that out. I'm sure for Monday we'll require a briefing as well on the ESCOM matters, particularly just briefly, a brief briefing Monday when we arrive in Pretoria, so that we can go through that. So I'll leave it to colleagues just to maybe if there's anything specific they would want the briefings to focus on, but I'm sure we'll want everything insofar as those municipalities are concerned and just the prevailing issues insofar as these two power stations are concerned. Ingula was one of them, but because of travel logistics, it would not have been possible. So we thought we'd rather prioritize Medupi and Busini. Busingula's online, it was just technical issues, so it's secondary. But our key focus is we're not preempting a situation. You are saying there are findings insofar as they're concerned, but we are concerned at the extent to which they have been, that they're not complete and that their costs are running. We just want to get into what is actually happening more specifically with them. So, colleagues, if there's anything, but I think that's where we are. And then we will, of course, then await from you the audit reports when you will be coming to us to give us the audit outcomes for the government departments and entities as we anticipate their arrival that as well. So I'm just trying to do housekeeping for us as we wait for appropriations to join us. AJ, over to you.
Thanks, Chair. Maybe let's dispense with the first point that you've raised regarding the briefing that you would need for ESCOM. ESCOM is one of those entities that are audited outside of the office. In terms of Section 4.3 of the Public Audit Act, there's a number of those Schedule 2 entities that, for very practical reasons, over a number of years, we've opted out of them. And all we do now, we often concur with the decision that is taken by the internal management of the institution after they have identified a statutory auditor. So the likes of ESCOM currently, as we speak, we do not sign off on them. I'm sure what we can do, because we are involved in other activities with the current auditors, we can facilitate with them. And that current auditor is Sizwe Ntsaluba Kobodo, Grant Ponton. So they are the current statutory auditors, and I think if you like a briefing on Monday on the recent work relating to the areas you're going to be visiting, I'm sure they'll be more than happy to oblige you. But the municipalities is largely all in our hands, so we can do what is required as far as that one is concerned. But for ESCOM, we can facilitate that with SNG, and I'm not too clear what your specific requirements are in that context, but if you want a broad briefing on Medupi and the other one, Kusile, we can relay the message and get them to arrange for that.
Mm-hmm. We'll facilitate the focus areas, and then we will station them, so by end of today, tomorrow, we'll tie down on those. And then send. Thank you. So we'll await that the audit for the municipalities. We welcome the colleagues from appropriations. If they can maybe sit this side, because the presenters are, the AG is sitting here, so this row is available to you. well, thank you very much, Chair. We are to start with the presentation by the Auditor General from the Office of the Auditor General. So we wish to welcome the Auditor General with his team. Just to say that we took the liberty to have a very fruitful briefing session with your team, and unfortunately with your absence, but it was as if everybody is there. So at the time, I think we had that a kind of benefit, mainly on the municipal or local government outcomes. We are meeting today on a workshop which seeks to make a number of us understand about all the intricacies of the Auditor General, Office of the Auditor General, as somewhat ascribed to, in as far as what is on the agenda currently. We are a SCOPA and present as well as part of this workshop. There is a committee which has just joined us because there is some kind, not necessarily overlap, but the fact that there must be a fair understanding on the pertinent matters that relate to the Auditor General. So we have to welcome the committee itself and say we are pleased that they have joined us. We hope that they will benefit as we expect from this sort of engagement. It's a committee on appropriations. We are going to receive that presentation. After the presentation, then would somewhat ask for that questions must be somewhat dealt with. And the fortune about this AG and the chair is that you could see among them that they are members of the committee on the Auditor General. So already you will find out that there is a form of a linkage out there. You see, I could see two members of the committee who serve in the committee which I chair, and the committee which we are primarily give account to one way or the other. So this is another fortunate angle of this session. So I'm going to give over to you, AG, to lead the presentation, and then thereafter we'll follow with comments and questions. Over to you, sir.
Oh, thank you very much, Chair. And once again, good afternoon to members of the committee and other colleagues present today. We have a pack that I think has been distributed. One is a document that has got 17 pages. It's headed Orientation Workshop, SCOPA Members. I'm going to start with that presentation. It's in that pack document. The second document, Chair, is another document with 29 pages. It's a document headed BAA Amendments, the key expansion to our mandate. So we're going to do this presentation in those two parts. Before I kick off, Chair, let me just acknowledge one of the points that Honorable Hlengwa made at the beginning when you suggested that the Auditor General, I can't remember whether I'll rephrase it, but he said is a wife, principal wife of SCOPA. So I just wanted to say on behalf of the members of the office, we do. So that we can tie it up now. When we call them to come here to account, at least you know that I said we do. So we're on the same side as far as the constitutional mandate of our office is concerned, and we will only send people who are close enough to the detail when they come to speak to you, so that they can give you the tidbits of what they've seen in the environments where they were auditing. Sometimes I get into trouble because I don't come here. And sometimes the reason I get asked to come is because people associate the work with the AG as the appointed person. But it's always better that the ones who are on the call face are the ones who come and brief you, because you are more interested in the detail than some of the headlines that are normally associated with what I say. So we'll try and make sure that in this sixth term of Parliament, we stick to that. But it doesn't mean that I will be absent from you permanently. There will be times when I come, but for the most part, the team that will lead these briefings on audit outcomes will largely be the corporate executives, who are the most senior people in those portfolios, followed by business executives who are running the different provincial audit offices together with other portfolios. And below them, there will be senior managers. So those are all experienced people who have got the requisite competences to take you to the level of detail that you might require. So I'd like us to make sure that as we begin this journey in the sixth Parliament, we're all on the same page, that the levels of delegation that we have in the office have been tested over a number of years. And we have never had a situation where senior managers come here and they say things that they cannot be able to verify based on audit work they've done. Now, Chair, let's step to the plate quickly. I'm on page 3 of the first presentation I said I'm going to kick off on. And perhaps just start with the mandate overall of the audit office, because we often assume whenever there's a new parliament, we've done this in the fourth, the fifth, as well as now the sixth parliament, we've always assumed the worst in terms of presenting our work as well as how we operate as an office. And that is always to assume that we know little about what is required in terms of the audit office, and so we normally expand on this presentation to make sure that we give you the best we can in terms of the insights into our work. And if you look at Section 188 of the Constitution, without exception, it says the Auditor General must audit and report on financial statements and financial management of government institutions. That is the principal authority that is given to the office through the Constitution. And following on that, there is a section, the one I referred to in respect to ESCOM, where the Public Audit Act says you may audit certain publicly funded institutions depending on considerations that the AG has looked at, and historically what has happened with the likes of ESCOM and other entities. There was a time some many years ago when the office had not yet embarked on a professionalization journey, meaning that the levels of people that were qualified in the office as chartered accountants who would be able to deal with the complexities and the intricacies that come with institutions and organizations like ESCOM, Transnet, and others, was of such a nature that the staff at the office at the time would not be able to do a diligent job in concluding on those audits. And that's why the Public Audit Act in 2004 gave us an option to walk away from certain audits and pass them on to other firms in the private sector to continue to audit them. But as I go through the presentation, Chair, I'll also share with you that we've now taken back quite a number of those other audits that we were not doing before. For example, South African Airways used to be audited by private audit firms, including PwC. We are now the principal auditors. The Airports Company of South Africa used to be audited outside of the office. But because we've now gathered strength, we no longer have chartered accountants in single or double digits. We've got about 600 odd of them in our institution, permanently resident, together with other technical skills that over the years we've accumulated. So there's no question about our capacity to deal with those ones, except for practical considerations sometimes that prevent us from taking much more than we can chew. Part of the risk management process that we go through, because we don't just run into a big animal that is going to become a nightmare if we have not got the necessary technical and other resources to execute on those audits. So gradually, if one looks at the last 5 years, I think we've taken back somewhere around 12 audits, including the likes of Safcol, including the likes of Denel, including the Development Bank of Southern Africa, Land Bank, and quite a number of others. Those are in-house audits. The ones that are outside our fold are few as we speak, which now gets me to step down from that Section 188, where we say that you must audit all of these entities that are publicly funded. However, there are exceptions that have always been part of our legislation. But where we are not involved directly as auditors, we normally attend audit committees of those particular entities so that we can listen in into what are the risks that are being engaged with in those entities, as well as to provide advice and support to those auditors who are principally there. For example, Transnet currently is being audited by SNG. We, since the beginning of this year, have been requested by public enterprises to make available some people from our side to reinforce the teams that are auditing Transnet from SNG side, with a view to fully assuming responsibility for the Transnet audit by the 2021 year end. So we are in a transitional process where we've begun to put in people in certain strategic areas of the audit, in the areas like supply chain, audit of performance objectives, as well as other critical areas of those audits. This is year one, where we've just completed this year's audit. Next year, we're going to take more responsibility until the 2021 year, when we will now be the sign-off institution on that audit. So there's a plan even with ESCOM, but the one for ESCOM has not been discussed formally and agreed, but there's also a plan of a similar kind over a period of time so that we can have all of these entities audited in the context of the approaches that have been developed in the Constitution as well as in the Public Audit Act. Now, our reporting responsibilities, Chair, derive from Section 20 of the Public Audit Act. Again, Public Audit Act instructs us to report on anything that we audit. So we must prepare an audit report which contains an opinion or a conclusion on fair presentation of the financial statements, firstly, as well as on compliance with applicable legislation, as well as on reported information against predetermined objectives. Now, if you look at the reports that we issue, you seldom hear reference to any of these three bullets on page three, because over the years we figured it out that it will be quite difficult for quite a lot of people to appreciate what is meant by the likes of fair presentation of the financial statements, because people, when they see auditors, they normally see the people who must come and investigate somebody who's done wrong. Whereas the standards of accounting as well as the auditing standards do not lend themselves to that expectation. That's generally the expectation of an ordinary person who says, how can such abuse escape the scrutiny of an auditor? Whereas according to the auditing standards as well as the legislation, they require us to report on fair presentation of the financial statements, which means that are these financial statements that have been presented of such a level that they are unlikely to mislead the people who are using them. Someone can take chances in financial statements and describe something as an asset. And if you look at the strict definition of an asset, a strict definition of an asset is something that is controlled by this entity, which is being used in pursuit of its activities with a view to generating economic benefits from it. Other people can describe all sorts of other things as assets, even if they were a period expense for the current period. There is no real economic benefit to be derived from what you spend. It just belongs to this period. You have to write it off in the income statement rather than carry it as an asset into the future. So if you didn't intervene as an auditor, you could have a litany of things like those that are described in so many ways that nobody can understand what they are. I'll give another closer example to home. When we were auditing the accounts of the Free State Agriculture Department some 3, 4, 5 years ago, we came across some of the elements of the financial statements which were described as transfers / subsidies. And these were payments that were being transferred, among others, by the Department of Agriculture to the Freddy Dairy project. They didn't describe them in their descriptive terms because they used a term that no one can figure out what a transfer / subsidy is. Hence, in those years, we disclaimed those financial statements because it did not make sense to us what is it that this transfer / subsidy is about. So that's what principally an audit is trying to achieve. Not that it will walk away from areas that look like they could be abused, for example. If there's a potential for fraudulent activity in financial statements, auditors will not look away, even though they are not required to chase fraud and corruption in financial statements. They are only required to report on whether the financial statements are a fair presentation or not. So that's the first part in terms of this first bullet. So that as we present these financial statements and the audit reports over the next couple of years, there is a fair understanding that we were auditing to report to the users of the financial statements that what has been described in the financial statements and what has been reported has been clearly understood in terms of the technical, the strict technical definition of things like assets, things like liabilities, for example. People have got liabilities that they've committed today. But what is also important to the people who exercise oversight is commitments that have been made on contracts yet to be committed with a particular entity for the future. So part of the financial statements is also to require the people who prepare them to disclose the extent of commitments. If you go to Medupi or you go to Eskom, you're definitely going to find in their financial statements commitments that run over a number of years because they've already committed to certain contracts that are long-term in nature. So the user of financial statements wants to see that picture because the decisions they are going to make are not just the decisions for this year. They are also decisions that will impact on future years Hence, it is important to have a picture about what is the extent of commitments of this particular entity that are going to have an effect on its cash flow. Because someone who's made a commitment over 5 years or so ought to pay for it. The money may not yet be appropriated, but somebody must disclose the extent of what is it that you owe somebody, even if you need to pay for it in the next 2, 3, or 4 years. So, Chair, that's what we focus on when we look at fair presentation of financial statements. And I'm going to elaborate on this to some of the stuff that is contained in our amendments when I speak about matters of material irregularity. How do we scrutinize those things that are of public interest? Because I'm sure the description of an asset or a liability in the books of account is of no interest to an ordinary citizen. Maybe they are interested in things like material irregularities where there's potential abuse of public resources. So I think with the coming into effect of our amendment of the Public Audit Act, it also allows us the scope to venture into that area. Even private sector auditors, that's why you've got the likes of Steinhoff, that's why you've got the likes of Hewlett, that's why you've got the likes of many other entities that have fallen over. It's because there's no requirement and there's no expectation for external auditors to scrutinize the extent of things like material irregularities. So I think it's a first for the public sector auditor, even ahead of private sector auditors, to have the instrument to look beyond fair presentation, in essence, when you audit financial statements. Then the next part in terms of what we need to report on, which is the compliance with applicable legislation, is pretty much derived from, I think, Section 213 or 214 of the Constitution. Keep me honest, I'm not too sure which one of the two. But what it says is that the only time monies can be appropriated from the National Revenue Fund is when there's an act of parliament that authorizes it, or if there's a direct charge that is authorized against the National Revenue Fund, meaning that the direct charge, for example, will be payment of your salaries is a direct charge to the National Revenue Fund as public representatives. Other than that, there's got to be an act of parliament. You can't build houses if there's no Human Settlements Act. You can't commit public funds to distribute water or to make water available if there's no Water Act. So those acts normally will also prescribe certain things that need to be complied with in order for those monies to be spent. So that when we audit the financial statements of an entity that is responsible for water, we also look at whether they have complied with applicable legislation on financial matters pertaining to their vote. So that's partly why in the audit we also look at compliance. We would look at compliance also because Section 216 of the Constitution requires that supply chain management processes, including procurement of goods and services, must be done in a manner that is transparent, in a manner that is competitive, and if somebody doesn't comply with that, that's why you will see in our report we will have a litany of reporting items that give you an insight into the extent of irregular expenditure. Because that expenditure is described in our reports as irregular to the extent that it did not comply with the prescripts governing supply chain management. Again, let me make the point that when we report on this irregular expenditure, we are not giving a substantive conclusion on whether fraud or otherwise has happened in the pursuit of the procurement of those goods and services. We are flagging the fact that the law governing supply chain management has not been complied with. To that extent, any expenditure that has been incurred on the back of that supply chain process not having been complied with is classified by definition in the PFMA as irregular expenditure. I'll extend again our insight on that area of expenditure when I deal with the levels of when I deal with the extent of irregular transactions that have been identified as part of the amended Public Audit Act. Then thirdly, Chair, when we also reflect on our reports, the performance against predetermined objectives, we often move from the premise, and I think the Public Audit Act also does the same, that none of this expenditure is appropriated for nothing. A lot of it is appropriated towards achieving certain objectives. And so as we scrutinize the financial statements, we are also interested in the stuff that people bought. Did you buy the things that are authorized in accordance with your appropriation, which translate to your mandate? Because there could be a combination of other things that an entity or department could be using this money for, but they are not necessarily against what they have committed to, because these predetermined objectives are developed at the time when they submit their budget requirements, at the time that they present their requirements and needs to portfolio committees, as well as when they develop their annual performance plans, the APPs. So we derive these performance objectives from there and say, is there a link between this expenditure and achievement of these objectives as you report them in your annual report as an accounting officer? So in essence then, Chair, Section 20, as you see it, doesn't say anything about the term clean audit. But to make it easy and to make it digestible, because remember these reports are not limited only to technical people. They also extend beyond those that have got the technical understanding of these three components. When an entity has succeeded through the audit in achieving all three of these objectives based on the independent evaluation of the audit, it then gets what is called a clean audit. Clean because it's passed the test with regards to these three things. You can already see that there's no reference to service delivery having been delivered in a particular locality or in a particular province. All you are saying is that all is well with regards to handling the finances, with regards to the transparency with which the finances are being handled, with regards to the availability of supporting documents for transactions that are recorded in the accounting records. All is well with regards to the people spending this money doing it in accordance with what the law requires of them, whether it is supply chain or whether it is other laws governing their activities. All is well with regards to the fact that we have been able to trace the validity, the accuracy, and the completeness of the information that they've reported on in the annual report with regards to their performance. So we have not gone to a particular place and tasted the water and said the water is good for human consumption. That we did not do. Because other people are going to wake up tomorrow and they are drinking water that's not good for human consumption. All we've done is the things they've recorded in their account, in their books, which indicate that they are delivering water, we found that those systems they are using are valid. Valid to the extent that no other person from somewhere else can come into that system environment and change the configurations. Accurate to the extent that when you add last month to what has been produced as water volumes this month, all makes sense because the cumulative totals have been done in a properly controlled system. Complete to the extent that there is no part of the record that should have been reported on in this year's annual report at the end of March, which has not so been reported. So I think that is what I thought I will stay on a bit longer, just to demystify sometimes this temptation to say that, but how is that entity clean when there's no service delivery? Because that relationship sometimes can be a little bit tricky. it's not completely scientific for us to come to this conclusion. Some of it is based on evaluating administrative systems, which do not necessarily talk to the experience of service delivery in most instances. Let me just use another example. In Gauteng, in the past year, when we reported on municipalities, you will know that in the whole of Gauteng, the only municipality that is clean is Midval. If we extended the relationship between a clean audit and service delivery, many of us would be tempted to conclude that the only people who receive the municipal services in Gauteng live in Midval, whereas other residents in other municipalities that are not clean are also experiencing receipt of services, despite the fact that these three components they have not been able to look after carefully. So the last point I want to make also is that it is typical, just by way of experience, it is typical of many of the entities that have passed this test to not have the temptation not to show for what they did with the money. Meaning that there's nothing to hide for them. They've been able to put on the table their finances, they've been able to put on the table their compliance record, and they've been able to report the things they bought with the money. Why would it be difficult for them to show how the services they've delivered are impacting on their residents? So that is to us the kind of link we can draw without necessarily making a direct comparison where you say the only ones who deliver services are the ones who are clean. The ones who are unqualified with other findings might be struggling with administrative systems, but are on top of the game when it comes to delivering services. So, Chair, when we then looking at these three bullets again on page 3, and we come to the conclusion that we are not satisfied with any of these, either because we did not get access to all the documents or everything that we look at doesn't make sense. The story changes every day. Nobody is in control here. Nobody takes ownership of what has happened over the year in regards to those finances that were allocated to them. That's when we issue opinions like a disclaimer, where we are, even us as auditors, none the wiser as to what has been done with those finances and how they've been handled. Who was responsible for checking them? Who was responsible for making sure that that particular 21 million expenditure, as an example, in one municipality in the Free State, where the only evidence to justify it was just a fence, but the budget was for a sports and recreation facility that needed to be built in that community, but 21 million rand later, all you have is a fence. It is those type of issues that we are looking at. Again, interrogating these three bullets, but I guess you will appreciate that there's an expanded set of procedures behind the scenes that ultimately come back to these three bullets. So I think I want to anchor this point, at least for purposes of this engagement, so that as we navigate all these matters that will come to you, the likes of fruitless and wasteful expenditure, the likes of irregular expenditure, and all sorts that will be reflected in the financial statements. Ultimately, that's what the auditors were doing. They were testing these three bullets at the highest level with a lot more detail that the business executives and the corporate executives will bring with them, which is the substantive evidence that they have gained during the audit. So it's not just going to be a case of we are saying this is what we have done, but we are able to also demonstrate, because of what the auditing standards require us, that we must obtain corroborative evidence that the conclusions that we are reaching could easily have been reached by another person doing the same work, evaluating the same systems, speaking to the same management about the same matters. And I think that is quite important, because once we deviate from that, we then start asking about why did you miss fraud? But there's a different conversation to that aspect. Moving on, we also have a mandate, Chair, to respond to people who request us to do special audits. If there's a request for us to go and do a special audit or an investigation or a performance audit where we evaluate whether the utilization of public funds was handled in a manner that is economic, effective, and efficient. I'm sure we'll recall a few years ago we did a number of performance audits where we looked at the use of consultants in the public sector. How can we come to a conclusion that this expenditure is effective, is efficient, and is economic? And we've done that exercise. We've done similar exercises in provinces like the Eastern Cape, where we did a performance audit on the delivery of human settlements through the budget of the Provincial Department of Human Settlements, where we're not just looking at the three bullets which are part of the statutory audit, but we are looking at the machinery that delivers houses, things like planning, project management of these, because some of the inefficiencies that result in fruitless and wasteful expenditure is when people employ external service providers but never manage them, and they end up with costs sometimes double or three times what they had budgeted for or agreed to. So it is that part of the other additional instrument which we normally report on in terms of Section 5 of the Public Audit Act. So whenever we are requested to perform an investigation or a special audit or a performance audit, we will do it in accordance with Section 5 of the Public Audit Act. We recently completed one where we looked at a follow-up performance audit that we did at Home Affairs with regards to their activities around management of border control, part of those things that we select on an annual basis. And so there's a number of those. I think if one wants to look at them, as well as the plan, we can share with you the plan of those that we want to look at as well, where we interrogate the delivery machinery of projects rather than looking at the handling of finances in isolation. So on page 4, so we audit and report, Chair. That's really what our instruction has always been for all these years. We go and audit, which means we are going to go and interrogate all these three bullets and come back and report as required in terms of Section 20. And our report has always carried with it a number of recommendations that are aimed at accounting officers doing something about our findings. We again recall that over the years, there's evidence that many accounting officers have ignored or disregarded a number of the recommendations of the audit office. That's why when many come to SCOPA, they will almost say exactly the same stuff they were talking about over the last 5 years, because they have not addressed the internal control weaknesses that were identified. Because for any one of those three bullets that I spoke to go the wrong way is when internal controls have not been diligently pursued in that entity. Because any one of them to get to that point have got to demonstrate in action that there is a proper system to manage the finances of the institution. There's a proper segregation of duties so that somebody doesn't start a transaction in the sense that they place the order and then they receive the invoice and then they receive the goods and then they post the invoice into the records and then they make the payment, that same individual. That is not allowed in a system of internal control because it could easily be manipulated if there are no independent checks along the way. And that is what, for the greatest part of our experience, has largely been ignored, where people have found it easy to alienate public resources because they know there's going to be no follow-through, nor are there going to be consequences for not fixing it. So that's historically where we come from. And hopefully when we talk about the amendments to the Public Audit Act, it will become clearer how we want to narrow the space with regards to that element. Because that's been part of the greatest feature of our audit reports, the fact that there have been no consequence for deviating from internal controls. And internal controls are not a nice to have. They are the difficult thing that causes a difficult conversation between people in finance and human resources in that organization. Internal controls are about the accounting officer having to be hauled over the coals by the CFO for not following the rules in respect of handling public finances. So those internal controls are what I think would be, shall I call it, an invincible fortress that all of us can rely on if we are to come to a conclusion that public finances are protected. There's no other one. There's only the internal controls and making sure that those disciplines of internal control are rigorously pursued to the point where somebody feels the consequence of not doing it. Because the other alternative is very expensive. Because the alternative, if not doing it as a preventative measure, it then means that you must go and hire forensic auditors after the event to go and search for that money. It can be expensive. I think the conversation you had earlier with ACTT tends to bring the after the event interrogation of transactions that ought to have been prevented through internal controls in some instances. Not that everything will be prevented, but the best form of protecting is to make sure that the preventative controls are stronger. And if you haven't had all of them adhered to, you then rely on reactive controls, which is your investigation, pursuing recovery of money you do not know which part of the world it is. That is also another expensive exercise. So we are trying to say here that when we report on these anomalies and these internal controls, it is best that they get addressed immediately so that this does not become a permanent feature of how our finances are handled. On page 5, as I said earlier on, if you look at the green bar, we're trying to provide clarity against what we do not do. As you look at the first bullet on the green bar, we provide assurance that the financial statements are free from material misstatements. If somebody decided to describe 200 million expenditure as plant, property and equipment, we can only be satisfied when we see the evidence that that's what you bought. So that's why we say that we give you the assurance as the user of the financial statements that somebody who writes 200 million for property, plant and equipment that is installed, for example, at Kusile as an example, you must be assured that any misstatement associated with that particular item on the balance sheet would have been scrutinized by the auditors. And the auditors are therefore giving you assurance that those numbers that have been given to you through the entity are free from material misstatements. But they are not a guarantee for the completeness and accuracy of all the information. Because where there's collusion in certain instances, senior management in an entity can collude and decide that they've already received something. But between them, if there is no proper segregation of duties, they can decide not to record it in their accounting records. So the auditor will be none the wiser, however diligent they are, if there is collusion at the highest level in the institution. And that's why an audit does not give you a guarantee on issues of completeness and accuracy of all the information. And the other reason for it is because an audit is done on a sample basis, and that sample gets extrapolated across the population. If it was not for that and we were chasing to give you a guarantee on completeness and accuracy of the information, then it would mean that for the 365 days of the year that we are interrogating, we must be physically sitting behind management every day in order for us to pick up every single transaction and every single document that management is processing. It's impossible. It can never happen anyway. So that's why we say that we do not guarantee the completeness of this information, but we give you assurance that we have used very strong tools to assess situations where people are trying to describe things differently so that they can pull wool over the eyes of those that want to assess the diligence and the probity with which the finances have been handled. The rest of those bullets on page 5 are trying to describe what I've just said now in more complicated terms. So I'm not going to spend more time on it. And then, having painted that picture just at a global level, I'd like you now to take you into the life of an auditor. I'm going to imagine that you are in an audit team and we are sitting here doing a risk assessment of these things that we find in these financial statements. So part of what we do at the beginning, before we even get to scrutinize these financial statements, we first agree the terms with management. That management, we are going to expect you to have all the account balances reconciled at the end of the year. Because you, together with your 25 people in your department, have been processing transactions left, right, and center. You've been buying flowers where it was necessary. For example, you have condolences with your colleagues. That's fine. Buy them. You've been buying cars. You've been hiring flights. You've been booking hotels. You've been sending people to all sorts of places. But when all of those transactions are collected at the end of the year and posted to the different accounts, the only way you as management would know that they reflect the substance of your decisions, you've got to reconcile those accounts so that you can be satisfied that the balances that you are going to report on reflect the substance of the decisions and the activities that you have undertaken as part of the funds that were appropriated to you. We, on the audit side, are going to request you to submit to us a set of financial statements, which is a record as required by the Public Finance Management Act and the MFMA, which is a record of the whole year's activities that were carried under your stewardship. So that's what the terms of engagement are going to be about. And once we do that, we then assess, based on our knowledge of that particular entity, based on our interactions with management, based on our previous year's scrutiny of these financial statements, as to what is the concentration of risk in this environment. You know, it's like, well, if we do a driving school, we know that maybe a 17-year-old who got their license 3 days ago is likely to be wobbly on the road than somebody who got their license in 1978, as an example. So we'll then be pointed at identifying those transactions that normally lend themselves to abuse. Things like payroll, if there are 28 people in that department, and you know that you pay on monthly basis 1.2 million towards their salaries, for argument's sake. If you look at every month for the 12 months and the pay is on or about 1.2, as an auditor, you know that if there was somebody who was short paid, they would have complained already. The only risk you have is someone being double paid. What is the chance that they could be double paid in an environment where the segregation of duties is in place? Somebody prepares the entry into the payroll, 28 employees, stays the same almost every month. Then you know as an auditor that I don't have to worry about that area because the level of risk associated with having the account for payroll being misstated is low. Whereas in procurement, if you have been allocated a 4 billion rands of expenditure for infrastructure, there are chances that not only the people inside the organization, but also other external service provider might be hovering around that environment because there are lucrative opportunities that come with this additional appropriation of 4 billion. So in terms of our risk assessment as auditors, we will say it is more than likely that the risk of validity of the expenditure for the 4 billion, the risk of the accuracy of that expenditure for the 4 billion, the risk of compliance with supply chain management prescripts for the 4 billion is likely to be high. And therefore, we are going to put a lot of emphasis and focus in that area more than we would do in the area of payroll. So that's what we do when we plan audits, so that we don't just try and chase everything, but we chase those areas that are likely to be susceptible to financial abuse. And therefore, the response of the risk, therefore, is then to design those procedures. Chair, I want to call it amaqhinga that we use in the process as auditors, because we've got our own secrets that we have to develop among ourselves so that we can stand a better chance and defeat those that were trained like us, who are now sitting on the other side, who are facilitating the wrongdoing. So we cannot then sit with them around the table and show them our tricks of the trade. So we develop the likes of your materiality. We develop the likes of your sample strategy. Which transactions are we going to focus on? How are we going to make the selections? What is going to be the extent and the rigor of the tests that you are going to perform on those transactions? So we spring a surprise on them because they cannot be too prepared. It doesn't matter whether they are also chartered accountants. Then we report. So that's what we do in the background, Chair. Sometimes we can miss something, but we try and be very diligent to make sure that the very obvious stuff we do not miss, because that's what could get us to be compromised in our reporting. So that's what we are trying to share on page 6 of the slide. And of course, when we report, as a last point on this page, is then the management report that we report on, where we share with management to say, management, as we were scrutinizing your accounting records for the past year, we found, among other things, that you do not have an asset register, but you've got a significant balance in the accounting records of 10 billion for argument's sake, but you don't have an asset register that is properly prepared. How do you know that of the fleet of vehicles that are recorded in your books as having been genuinely bought and paid, how do you know that you are still in control of them and are under your use? Because it could happen that in the changeover period as a municipality, some of the people were given these vehicles which are not marked in the name of the municipality, and they are driving them around. And when the term comes to an end, some councillors just drive away and never come back with that car. Where do you go and look to find whether you actually had a Corolla that belongs to the municipality? Maybe sometimes they didn't even register it in the name of the municipality. But the debit with regards to the vehicle, remember that debit, I said, is an asset controlled by the entity from which economic benefits are to be derived, is properly described in the books as an asset, representing a vehicle you no longer have, because you do not have a fixed asset register, which is your control point for the movement of the physical assets. So that's what we report on in the management report, to say, management, are you aware that with all your big balances in the books, they are not really properly represented in the form of an asset register? So that's what goes to a management report. Again, it carries recommendations with it. It is these recommendations where there's been an internal control breakdown that we want management to respond to and to address as quickly as possible. Whereas in the audit report, as I already indicated, based on the requirements of Section 20, we report in the audit report on those fundamental weaknesses and breakdowns in internal control. We report on those three points that I raised earlier on in regards to fair presentation, compliance, and so on. And so you see on page 7 the different audit conclusions that we normally come to as an audit office, where I've already indicated what a clean one is, as well as the other extreme, which is a disclaimer. And in between, there are other types of opinion, either an adverse opinion or a financially qualified opinion with findings. So, Chair, when an entity has been qualified, it means that when you say to us, you've got transfers and subsidies, and we do not know what that represents, and you can't show it to us, then we are not happy. So we express our unhappiness with the things that management is reporting in their financial statements by making them qualified. By saying qualified, we mean that we are drawing the attention of the user of these financial statements to those matters that we are describing, which lead us to the conclusion of a qualification. So in essence, you are saying that when they come to SCOPA and they are qualified, SCOPA must not ignore that what gives rise to a qualification. SCOPA should not ignore that. However they may want to explain it, whether philosophically or otherwise, SCOPA must not ignore that, because we as auditors, having seen what we saw, having interacted with the entity on those matters, we are drawing your attention to the concentration of issues that are likely to result in finances being laid astray or being used for purposes not intended. I think there's much appreciation for disclaimer, because that's when people start hiding things, or even hiding themselves sometimes. You know, they just call in sick, and then they never appear in front of the auditors for the next 2 weeks, because they know the statutory deadline for reporting on their accounts is 31 July. So if I disappear for the next 2 weeks, and I'm accountable for that set of accounts, the auditors have no authority to come and drag me out from wherever I am. Probably what they'll do is just to disclaim an opinion. But it doesn't mean that the wrongdoing that I'm sitting on is gone. Now, coming to our work, which relates to what we do in Parliament, this is not much of additional knowledge about what you already are aware of. On page 8, it's just a re-emphasis of the key areas of work that we interface between ourselves as AG, as well as yourselves as the oversight, but also other forums that are there in Parliament, including the Speaker's Forum and many other legislative committees, like your portfolio committees, where we go and engage them quarterly on their in-year monitoring processes. Just also to flag to them that there are many deficiencies in the financial management systems they need to be aware of, because while they are looking at whether there is delivery of these commitments and objectives, they also need to look at how do the finances compare with regards to what is being used, what is still left, and so on. And for this, Chair, perhaps let me just bring up something. We were made aware a few weeks ago through the report that was published as part of the annual report or results for ESCOM, where 20 billion in red ink was reported. And I guess the point I'm trying to get to here is to say, when a loss of an entity is so significant in a financial year, is it only arising in month number 12? Or was there awareness of us moving in the direction of 20 billion red ink, maybe from quarter 1, from quarter 2, from quarter 3? That's what these in-ear monitoring engagements are about for us, so that we can raise the flag at the point when it arises. If we had a budget to make a 200 million profit, but in year one we are already 5 billion in red ink, that's a significant red flag, which nobody must wait for until it becomes 20 in quarter four, as an example. I'm just using this as an illustration of the kind of oversight work that will make sure that the preventative mechanisms are put in place where they should be. And I'm not critiquing the loss. I'm just saying, in principle, when we are in an oversight position, we ought to be understanding every quarter where are we headed, what's the budget, where are we now. Otherwise, the 20 billion looks like a huge surprise when we see it in month number 12. And on page 9, we're just sharing with you the trends over the past 10 years with regards to the audit outcomes of national, provincial, and local government. And of course, we have annotated each one of these bars. And I'm sure you'll see when we come up with the next general report, which is coming later in the year, we often use the same colors to describe these five different audit outcomes I spoke to on page 7. Green, yellow, purple, pink, red. And suddenly there's an emerging blue, which is the outstanding audits. Those people who escaped scrutiny, either because they did not submit their financial statements on time or there are difficulties with them providing the auditors with the requisite evidence. So we can see that even if we look at this over the past 10 years, it has not been a happy set of results when you look at the entire system combined, both national, provincial, and local government. Way back to 08-09, right through to the present, things started looking a little promising in the years 2014-15 and 15-16, and it looks like there is a sharp decline and a sharp reversal to our experience of years before that. And I think it's one of those areas we need to be paying close attention to, because this graph on page 9, which describes these different audit outcomes, represents close to 1,000 audit reports, local government, national, and provincial. So these percentages are percentages where we've observed financial statements of close to about 1,000 for both national, provincial, and local government. Levels of irregular expenditure, as I've said, and defined it to say that some people argue that irregular expenditure is not necessarily corruption. Some people argue that. Then we say, okay, let's understand what it is necessarily. Because if it is not necessarily corruption, then let's understand what is it necessarily. And we've now moved into a space where we are actually going to understand it by invoking this principle of a material irregularity in financial statements. Because clearly, others would say that, well, even if I have so much irregular expenditure, I have delivered what I needed to deliver. But the question is, at what cost? How much more did you pay? How could you have avoided having to pay double or three times what you did? Why was it not transparent if you were so happy about delivering on it? So those are the questions that I think still remain for oversight to keep asking, to say, well, we may, at the end of the conversation, agree that it is not necessarily corruption as you suggest, but please explain what it is so that we can understand it for what it is rather than for what it is not. Because sometimes what it is not hides what it really is. And we'll find that in this irregular expenditure, as we have seen, Chair, when we looked at the first phase of our implementation of these amendments, that included in some of these items of irregular expenditure. There are indeed transactions that are questionable. We hope that the implementation of this amended act will throw light into those areas that were previously not understood. Just as a way of teasing your appetite on this, we have not yet reported on all of them. We will be reporting on them in October thereabouts when we finalize the analysis. But having selected 16 in this cycle, because our act was finally agreed and promulgated for 1 April. So we didn't wait. We then had to get the machinery in action to apply some of the provisions of the act. But we couldn't do it for every single entity. And we agreed with our standing committee on the AG in the 5th Parliament that we are going to go a phased-in approach from year one onwards. So our experience having selected 16 in the provinces as well as nationally, we've already identified well around 60 material irregularities that previously were not a subject of scrutiny of the audit. Now think about it, Chair. 16 triggered 60. I don't know how many all of these 1,000 audit reports are going to trigger if 16 have already triggered 60. When you've got the entire population subjected to an audit, taking into account the experience of the outcomes per page 9, it means that there's a field full of transactions that could fall foul of the definition of a material irregularity. So we have to wait until we roll out the entire amendment to be able to have the real picture of what is it that is a material irregularity. Because a material irregularity doesn't come with manga-manga business where someone has to theorize about what it is not. It is real transaction with real evidence and real documents that support that transaction. Wasteful and fruitless expenditure, again, another one, Chair. I'm not going to spend too much time. It's been on a high. And this is basically expenditure that is incurred in vain where it could have been avoided. Inefficiencies like not honoring the commitments with your creditors, and then they impose penalties and interest. And now you've got to take that money from elsewhere in order to meet those kind of obligations with your suppliers. So that's what we are highlighting here to say, if efficient pursuit of transactions was carried out, you could have avoided having to incur that expenditure. And unauthorized is also growing up, because the more money you spend on things that were never allocated for it, the more you're going to dip into allocations of the future. And then you end up spending on monies that have not necessarily been authorized or appropriated in subsequent years. But also that one is also taking a significant increase, especially in local government. If one looks at page 12, local government has had a significant growth in the levels of unauthorized expenditure. We do not know. I'm sure there must be some explanations for it, either to do with the fact that whatever is allocated is always insufficient. We are not interrogating that part, because that's probably for other decision makers to look at that part. But I think ours is just to say, here's expenditure, but there's no requisite allocation or budget against it. On page 13, we take a view here, Chair, that having reported on these levels of irregular expenditure, as an example, just if we focus on the big red bar of irregular expenditure where we say it has not been dealt with, what you are communicating here is that of all the irregular expenditure that has been incurred over the years, about 89% of it has not been dealt with. Not being dealt with is more to do with the fact that the law requires accounting officers and the entity to institute an investigation of those instances of irregular expenditure with a view either to submit it to National Treasury for condonement or to pursue a different path if that investigation triggers evidence that somebody was abusive of the system. None of it, 89% to that extent, has been dealt with. And this is cumulative over all the past years that we have reported on irregular expenditure. We are hoping, Chair, and we've already made the approach to the SIU in respect to this, because as you would know, in the past years, and they've said it themselves earlier, that they have been working on a number of investigations which came as a result of presidential proclamations, where proclamations were issued and they were directed to pursue investigations in municipalities or certain departments. I'm sure we all know those proclamations in past years. What remains, and we've already requested those reports from the SIU, so that we can then look at our cumulative figure, this figure, which is a historical figure cumulative to the present, to see how many of these were a subject of the SIU investigation, so that we can begin to take them off the list in order to reduce the extent of that number. Because this is just a cold figure for us where we did not receive any reports. We hope that the SIU will pass on some of those, and then we can say, here are the proclamations that were issued in 2008, for argument's sake, or 2011, which point to investigations for a category of certain municipalities that had, because those proclamations, if one looks at them, were issued after the audit reports were released, which means they are proclamations that contain the information that was in the audit reports anyway. So it's a matter of us comparing notes with the SIU to really get to what is it that has not been dealt with properly at this stage. But we'll bring that feedback as soon as we receive that information from the SIU. And I think also they've indicated to us that the reports belong to the person who requested them. So we've made the approach to both the SIU and the presidents, because that's where the proclamations came from. Then the root causes of many of these, and we've made enough noise about them over the years, including the fact that there's been a blatant disregard, as I said earlier on, for these controls and compliance, as well as carrying out recommendations. Some capacity gaps were identified in administration, where people who do not have the requisite competences were assigned certain duties to prepare financial statements and accounts for budgets that are much bigger than what they can handle, and sometimes that creates an opportunity for those that are cleverer to find ways to take without them picking it up in due time. Vacancies and instability were another feature, where in an environment, Chair, where an accounting officer is suspended and there are seven senior managers who are technically supposed to report to the accounting officer, when the accounting officer is not there, those seven senior managers have got nobody to report to. It might be a thing that everybody is happy about, the fact that someone is suspended. But the internal control has been weakened in the process for as long as nobody with the requisite competences has been put in that position to replace that person. So what do you think the CFO is doing? What do you think the supply chain head is doing, the head of strategy, the head of HR, the head of another department? Who are they reporting to in the meantime when the accounting officer is sitting at home for 12 months or more? So that's the big issue, I think, for us. The issue of instability is not just the fact that there's nobody doing the work of that person who was meant to be doing that work. The question must drill down to the senior managers. What are they doing? Who are they reporting to? Who's holding them to account? Because what could have led to the suspension of the accounting officer is possibly some activity that triggered from those senior managers as well. So I think in looking at some of these issues of vacancies, especially at those key positions of accounting officer, we now need to find a way to say, is somebody else in the meantime supervising the activities of those senior managers? Because that's where the biggest transactions are going to be authorized by the DDGs and the chief directors and so on. Some of the efforts, Chair, which I'm not going to spend too much time on, that we have triggered as per page 15 and page 16. These are our ongoing activities that I know members are fairly well exposed to in terms of our engagements as an office. But one of the key ones which I would like to speak to is a recent introduction of what we call the status of records review. We've gone ahead and volunteered our time to accounting officers to say, we're not just available at the point when you close the books and pass on the financial statements to us. We are also available as an audit institution to you at the end of any of those other quarters preceding the final financial year end. So that if you want us to have a look at your trial balance at the end of the second quarter, feel free to prepare the trial balance, take out the accounts that you should be reconciling, and show us where have you reconciled them. How have you balanced the books at the end of the second quarter? What are the intricacies of transactions that you've carried out that might catch you at the year end? Because some of these things are not just a straightforward exchange of money, give me something else. There are also other accounting requirements that are more technical that you need to be aware of. We'd like to engage you on those so that you can be in a better state of preparedness come the end of the audit. And that part, we don't want to take them by surprise. We want to be open to them to say, we can come to you at the end of month number 9 in December before year end, just to get a free run, if you like, so that we can give you a sense of where you're going wrong, what you need to embrace, what you need to take into account, and if you've got a vacancy in your CFO position and you do not have your accounting records properly reconciled, it's probably the right time for you to seek help. So that you don't come up and say, well, I've employed the services of an external service provider and you are doing that in May, 2 weeks before you are required to submit financial statements. Because if you didn't keep the records and nobody was supervising the transactions, that person who comes in May is going to come cold, and it's possible that they may not be able to help you, but you're going to discover after you've paid them a lot of money that it was not worth it. We have some examples of where this has happened, Chair. In one municipality in Limpopo, where they struggled and they didn't have this discipline throughout the year, and they thought that, well, they've got the budget, they're going to go and seek an external service provider, and in one financial year, that municipality had a bill of about 12 million. 12 with 6 zeros before the comma for the services of an external service provider, in addition to the finance department with a fixed employment cost. That's the kind of expenditure that we've seen in some places, only because they didn't do the necessary thing at the point when they were required to do it. I pause here, Chair, in respect of the first presentation, which was largely about giving you a sense, and I'm sure this we will develop some of these engagements with you as we progress the next 5 years, Chair. I'll take guidance from you if you want me to pause here just to engage with some of these, or shall I go straight to the PAA amendments presentation?
No, thanks, IG. What we think we must do, we have had members where we had to come here with haste. If you can take just a 5-minute comfort break, and then thereafter we come back and get into, I think we must have the entirety of the presentation, and then we deal with it once and for all. Just 5 minutes comfort break, and then we come back. 5 minutes, please. Okay. Get a fair understanding of the overall areas that we thought that we must touch on, and then in those matters then we then begin to engage. Colleagues, can you allow the Auditor General to take us through?
Thank you, Chair.
I am the seller.
Okay, thanks, Chair. No, thank you very much, Chair. The next part of the presentation, which, as I said, is the PAA amendments. I'm not going to be more than 30 minutes. At least by 5:30, I must be done with this one. At least this one is fresh stuff, unlike the previous one, which goes back to 1911. Yeah, the first one. So this one is like almost half a year old, so it's going to be quick, even though the pages are more than the previous one. Now let's get cracking on that one, Chair. Page 3, I'm on now. Yeah, on page 3, Chair, I'm just we're just going to highlight for your appreciation the three developments that have emerged with the amendments to the Public Audit Act. I think there's a booklet you might have, which is a recently printed booklet, where in the pack, you didn't put it in the pack? It's yeah, that one. If you look at that one, between page 15 and page 19, we don't have enough copies? Page 15 and page 19, those pages, 15 to 19, is where, if you can please share some of the copies, if you have extra copies from our side, with the members, please, of that amended act. You haven't got enough. Oh, I thought they are in the pack, but we'll organize more copies. But I was just going to make reference to the recently printed amended Public Audit Act and the main amendments that were made with the amendments to the Public Audit Act, as I said, are on page 15 to 19. I'm not going to make reference to them, Chair, for purposes of today's presentation, but I just wanted members to be aware where to find the detailed act as amended. Maybe let's go straight to page 5. Yeah, page 5 of this presentation. And perhaps I'm going to stay on this page, Chair, because this is where the critical step change has come in respect of these amendments. On page 5, we are speaking about the concept of a material irregularity. And I'd like to assert the point that the biggest thing these amendments have brought is not the fact that there will be a certificate of debt or there will be a binding remedial action if the recommendations are not implemented. The biggest thing for us that the amendment has brought is to introduce the concept of a material irregularity in the audit of financial statements of government and public entities. That, to us, is a central and most important and perhaps most fundamental development if one thinks about what is new and what has been introduced in these amendments. I say this because without this material irregularity provision, there is no instruction for the Auditor General to look beyond the normal scrutiny of financial statements. In the past, as I was saying earlier, we would scrutinize financial statements and hope for the best with regards to the responsiveness of accounting officers or those that are charged with oversight. But with the introduction of a material irregularity, it's brought back to us as auditors to say, if you identify an irregular expenditure, in order for us, those that are charged with oversight, to not get confused by all sorts of philosophical argument as to what it is and what it is not, please look deeper into that environment. And through your audit, as you are doing the audit, find out whether there are any instances of non-compliance, contravention of the legislation, fraud, theft, or a breach of a fiduciary duty. Somebody who was meant to exercise certain responsibilities to protect the public purse but did not so exercise those responsibilities, hence the breach of a fiduciary duty. And such material irregularity, when you are going through your work, must arise during the course of an audit. It cannot be some envelope that you were given by somebody in the street pointing to allegations about this, that, and that in a particular entity. You as an auditor are authorized through the instrument of the audit while you are conducting a statutory audit under the Public Audit Act, and some of the characteristics of that non-compliance, contravention, fraud, or theft must have resulted or must be likely to result in a financial loss to the state. So it gives us a very broad area to navigate when we audit financial statements. We don't just look for whether you have expressed and described transactions the way they ought to be described. Once we know and once we have a suspicion that this transaction lends itself to a potential material irregularity, let's now go practical and say, if these provisions were in place and we were auditing the municipalities for the year that ended in June last year, which we already reported on now, and among the things that we reported was the fact that a municipality in the Free State spent 21.7 million and the only evidence they could show for it was just a fenced piece of ground instead of a sports and recreation facility, as those funds were allocated for that. If we had found it under this dispensation of this amended act, that particular transaction would have been a material irregularity. Why so? Because there are all sorts of non-compliance with regards to its expenditure. There are contraventions of legislation that prescribed that you will build a sports and recreation facility for this allocated amount rather than just a ground with a fence. There's potential for fraud definitely in a transaction like that. Some theft ought to have happened if 21.7 million is meant to buy a fence only. There's a breach of a fiduciary duty because there are people who are supposed to have overseen that transaction and did not do what they were required to do with regards to it. It has, at least at face value, and is possibly likely to continue if there are additional payments to be made, result in a material financial loss. So it's not an insignificant loss. It's not a loss that arises from somebody who was hungry on a particular morning and decided to go and buy a sandwich out of petty cash. This is a material financial loss by definition. So that is the kind of introduction that we have had, whereby when we come across these transactions, we've got to scrutinize them for these elements to make sure that we can come to a conclusion that this financial loss or the misuse or loss of a material resource or a substantial harm to a public sector institution. No doubt that that municipality, in relation to its commitment to the people that live in that area, its image has already been harmed because monies were spent for some commitment that was made for the delivery of a particular good or service which has not been forthcoming, but the money is already out of the bank. Many credits have gone against the bank account purportedly as a payment for what ought to appear in the books as a debit, being the asset, sports and recreation. What did we find? A ground with a fence. Incomparable to that which was supposed to be received against the 21.7 million. So that's what this definition is about, Chair. And so it will be that when you look at the audit outcomes that we are going to be sharing in the latter part of this year, there will be somewhere around, I'm sure the number might change depending on the finalization of the responses from the accounting officers. But with the 16 samples that we've selected, we are already working today as we speak with about 60 instances that are falling foul of this definition, which were picked up from the financial statements. So the Act says then, once we have identified a material irregularity in the audit of financial statements, I'm now on page 3, I'm just backtracking a bit to those three areas of the mandate. It says, once we have identified that particular matter, again, if we stay with that 21.7 million, it's already a matter that is in our audit reports. If, as auditors, you've determined that this particular project that was being delivered is so complex in terms of the intricacies of its delivery, because remember, some of these things, Chair, will require engineering expertise when you put them together. They will require expertise of various kinds, depending on what that project is. So there could be all sorts of intricacies and complexities that come with the delivery of, let's keep this example of ours, of the sports and recreation facility. To the extent that it does not lend itself to the kind of knowledge that you would expect of statutory auditors, because they might need a lot more than what an auditor has in order for them to get to the bottom of what happened. Hence, the Act has given us the right to refer those identified material irregularities to other public bodies for further investigation. Because, as I said in my presentation earlier, in the earlier part, our instrument is to identify those instances that did not comply with what was expected. It might happen that we do not have the expertise to get to the bottom of an investigation, because we may have a team of people who are trained in accounting, but this might require somebody who has also got some other expertise to get to the bottom of why did we end up with 21.7 million and only show a fence for it. So that's why we have a referral power, which means that when we identify these material irregularities, we are required to refer them to the likes of the SIU, to the likes of the Hawks, if it is appropriate for that particular entity to pursue the investigation, or if we have discovered that we do have that capacity to do it ourselves through our investigations unit, based on that which I spoke about in terms of the Section 5 reports, we can also do it ourselves. But the power to refer is to actually know that you do not have a shortage of institutions you can take a matter like that to. So that once they finish the investigation, they must then return the final outcome of that report to us. And then we process whatever has come out of that investigation based on the recommendations of that relevant public body that carried out the investigation. So it is not going to be a case of we've reported it to the accounting officer, we are waiting for them, even for 8 years sometimes, for them to respond. It will happen in the financial year that the matter arose, so that we can get further clarity and transparency on what was behind this material irregularity, who is to be held responsible for it, and so on and so on. So that is the first part that arises from the introduction of the material irregularity. Then, Chair, once we've identified some of these items as part of our normal scrutiny in the audit, we are required to make a recommendation. Now, the recommendation that we need to make on material irregularities, the amendment prescribes that we must make it in the audit report. So the audit report, which goes with the financial statements, if there's a material irregularity identified, we will say, we have completed the audit of Municipality A, as in this case, that example of the municipality in the Free State. We have identified total payments of 21.7 million in respect of a planned delivery of a sports and recreation facility. All the budgeted amounts of 21.7 million have been exhausted, and upon physical inspection of the delivery of this project, the auditors were only able to find a fence. That is what will be written in that section of the audit report. So anybody reading the audit report knows that in these financial statements there is a material irregularity. Because a material irregularity is not a line item on the face of a balance sheet, on the face of an income statement, on the face of a cash flow statement. So we've got to describe it in almost the terms that I'm describing it now, so that anybody reading that particular audit report knows immediately that this is not about philosophizing or whatever about whether this thing has resulted in corruption or not. The words that describe it say, 21.7 million left the bank for a fence, which is probably X square meters in size. That kind of detail will find its way into that. So that anybody reading the report can appreciate that 7.6 square meters of fence unlikely to be bought with X amount. And so the recommendation then will be saying to the accounting officer, please exercise your responsibilities as an accounting officer in terms of Section 38 of the Public Finance Management Act. Or, if it's a municipality, exercise your statutory responsibilities in terms of Section 62 of the MFMA. If you don't, then Section 39 of the PFMA will kick in, or Section 65 of the MFMA will kick in, because this is financial misconduct. And which consequences are whatever those particular additional sections of those two key legislation prescribe. So that is the extent to which that particular recommendation will say to the accounting officer, Chair. And the reason for this is because the highest accountability in the administration of that particular institution is the accounting officer. He or she must explain on behalf of those that may have caused it under his or her watch without having done something to prevent it. Because the provisions of Section 38 and 62 are quite clear. One of the things that you must do as an accounting officer is to prevent all instances of irregular expenditure. You must recover all monies due to the entity. You must institute all systems of internal control to make sure that the finances of the institution are handled in an effective, efficient manner. That's clear, black and white. It's already there in legislation. So what this thing does, it says, we're not going to make the recommendations in a vacuum when the Act already prescribes certain obligations at the highest level of accountability. Unfortunately, when the Act was amended, it was concluded with that understanding that this is not just about targeting somebody, it's about bringing to life the spirit and the intention of the Act. Now, there's a case that was reported on in the Western Cape, in Oudtshoorn, where the municipal manager of that municipality was taken to court with regards to issues pertaining to irregular expenditure and irregular award of contracts to the extent of about 2 million and something. And in his defense at the High Court, he argued that I was instructed by the mayor and the speaker or the chief whip, whoever it was, because this was an emergency and the court would have none of it. The court pointed to the responsibilities that are there in the MFMA as to what you ought to have done in the exercise of your fiduciary duties as an accounting officer, because it's a seriously senior position for you to have enough to do something about the fact that someone insists that you must do something inappropriately. So that's one part that I thought is important, Chair, to highlight. And when this recommendation is made, it's not going to be a recommendation that can be implemented any time. It's not open-ended. Through the audit, we will say, we recommend that you exercise your responsibilities as an accounting officer within 90 days, for example, from the issuing of this report. I'm just using 90 as an example. But there will be a fixed period within which the accounting officer ought to exercise their responsibilities in addressing the identified and reported material irregularity. Come the expiry, let's say, of 90 days. Immediately after the expiry of 90 days, if there's no evidence to show that the accounting officer has taken those requisite steps to address the matter, that recommendation automatically now becomes a binding remedial action. From day number 91, it now becomes a binding remedial action. We are no longer nice about it, in essence. The instruction is you shall then exercise your responsibilities to implement that recommendation which was given to you 90 days ago. And the remedial action will have its own time as well, so you can get a chance as an accounting officer to figure it out how best to put back into the system the equivalent of 21.7 million, whether in money terms or in whatever form, but figure it out what is the best way to restore to the system what ought to have been in place had you exercised your fiduciary responsibilities in respect of that transaction. And that binding remedial action upon its expiry, then we are in the territory of considering the issuance of a certificate of debt in the name either of the accounting officer or the accounting authority responsible for the exercise of fiduciary duties in that particular institution. That's the long and short of what has been amended in the Public Audit Act. I would have said, let's just stay with page 3 on this, and the rest of the pages, keep them for our homework as we refresh our appreciation of the knowledge of what is contained in these amendments. And perhaps just as a guide to how that homework must translate itself, we have issued regulations to the Standing Committee on the AG because we are required to bring this with some regulations, which regulations I think are already in possession of the of Parliament and the committee, and they were approved and all of that. We are more than happy to, well, of course, we are sharing them here through this flowchart so that we can see that there's some level of diligence that will be applied in the background. For example, just as an example, one of the regulations says that, please, once you've identified a material irregularity, let's say around the month of June during the audit, give the accounting officer 20 working days so that they don't turn around and say you are unreasonable. How are they going to figure out this complicated transaction? Fortunately, it might have happened this year, so they still have a chance, but we give them 20 days just to be reasonable for them so that they can go back if they want to ask questions. Maybe when the transaction happened, genuinely, they were probably off sick by assumption. Maybe 20 days will help them figure out with those that they left behind as to what is this thing that's being brought to me by the auditors. Do you have an answer? What was this about? What happened? So it will create that particular conversation internally in the institution, because it's not a case of we pick this and now we're going to run around and, you know, use it as a flag that we found something. You know, when someone has found something that nobody has found, they probably want to be seen first by everybody having found this thing. So we're going to be reasonable, and the regulations quite clearly say, give the accounting officer 20 days so that they can go back. While you are in the audit, they might find an answer and correct that transaction or put back into the system what ought to have been within that period before you sign the audit report. Let's argue that, for example, we've done that and we've given that particular material irregularity to the accounting officer. They return within 20 days with a believable answer, supported by evidence, and. All that is required now is for the auditors to process that matter through the audit, and if there's a substantive answer that explains what was not immediately apparent on the basis of what the auditors picked up, then that matter will go away. So it's not really a retributive process. It's a process that is also trying to get the accounting officer to be sensitive to the fact that the audit does pick up things that may not also be known to the accounting officer. It gives them the chance to exercise their responsibilities in terms of the law in restoring the financial health of the system. And of course, on page 6, Chair, we've set out some examples of the typical material irregularities, some of which we have already picked up, some of them we also are working with currently. But let's think about a disclaimer of an opinion. A disclaimer of an opinion in many ways ought to become an automatic matter for further interrogation as part of material irregularities, because if you're a repeat disclaimer, you probably are sitting in a comfortable position. In clear English, nobody reports on you because nobody knows about what you've done because you've not given them anything to prove that your transactions are what they purport to be. So you need to be investigated. You need to be handed over for referral so that somebody can figure out what are these contracts and these documents and these invoices and these explanations that you are not surfacing to the auditors. And I think that's part of what we will be tracking in respect of disclaimers, because now it must be one of those interventions that eliminates the continuing growth of disclaimers, because someone has got some information which they are not bringing forth for scrutiny. And then the MI process in terms of the regulations is what we have described here on page 7. Page 7. The referral process as well as the certificate of debt up to page 12, Chair. So those flow charts basically give you a sense of how the flow of these three key elements of the amendment are going to operate. But we've also got it in a document where it is in narrative form as well, so that as you are reading it, you can also process it through this flow chart so that you can begin to see which steps are going to happen when and how and all of that. So I'm going to skip this, Chair, so I don't have to keep you with the detail, but at a point, if you are interested in getting into the detail of those regulations, we'll be more than happy to take you through them. But for now, I think we've given the document for you to read and the flow chart to follow. We've also cross-checked some of the, on page 13, some of the main legal considerations. There's no doubt that we operate, and we are going to deal with these amendments in a very litigious environment where people are going to start contesting, questioning and challenging and submitting certain things to the judges and asking them to, I don't know that English term they use when they say they must take your report and put it on the side. Something like that. While everything else is happening, take this report and put it here so that you don't worry about it and you worry about other things. So we will come across things like those. Now, we've tested some of these in terms of these amendments to say, is there an overreach on what we do? And we've got legal counsel input and opinion to suggest that, well, we are within the realm of what we ought to do in respect of these amendments. Does the law permit strict liability in the manner in which the Amendment Act has been positioned? Answers have been provided with regard to legal tests on those matters as well. The commencement date, can it be retrospectively applied? The answer is a no-no. Only to the extent that transactions that happened prior to 1 April find themselves in reports that are issued after 1 April will they be included in these amendments. Otherwise, this caters for transactions that happened on or after 1 April. Which audits or audit-related services do these amendments apply to? They apply to the audits that are carried out as statutory audits of financial statements per the Public Audit Act, those that require to be reported on in terms of Section 20, not those ones that require to be reported on in terms of Section 5. How will the rights of accounting officers or accounting officers be protected? We think that they are, because there's a process that they must go through. Even before you get to the possibility of issuing a certificate of debt, there are certain representations that they make. If somebody has searched and searched and searched and can find nothing, they have an opportunity to speak and to reduce that which they believe is their story in writing. And there will be an independent supervisory mechanism that is outside of the office that will be tasked with listening to those representations and applying their mind to whether the auditors have done a decent enough job to come to that conclusion. So in terms of putting that particular independent assessment committee, call it that, we have basically said it must be a combination of somebody with legal training and experience, somebody with deep financial knowledge and expertise, and one or two other people who bring other experience with some public sector knowledge to come together in that committee and figure it out themselves without us being involved. So those people who will be constituting that committee will make a recommendation to the person who is the Auditor General at that time, which means that the accounting officer cannot say that there's been foul play, I have not been given a chance to express myself in respect to those considerations. So if that committee then says, we think that you exercised your responsibilities accordingly, then the Auditor General will be required to proceed to issue a certificate of debt. And there's a copy of it, not necessarily a copy, but the, how it would look like. So it will have somebody's ID number, somebody's name as it appears on the ID, the amount, and the date by when they must make good the amount that is being claimed from them. And then that certificate will be delivered to the executive authority of that institution. Now, the executive authority in the case of a department or a province could be an MEC or a minister. In the case of a municipality, it will be the council, which executive authority will have to deliver that certificate of debt to either the accounting officer or the accounting authority. And then they will do it in accordance with the laws that govern the recovery of public funds from whoever is owing money to the state. Chair, as I said, I wanted to just flag and highlight those specific matters. The rest of what I have here is explanatory slides that really expand on what is an irregular expenditure versus what is a material irregularity. I think those are just for enhancing members' appreciation of the differences between what we were dealing with in the past in addition to what we are dealing with now. Let me close it out by saying, Chair, that on page 26, perhaps the team has reminded me that I must not forget on page 26 to share with the committee those auditees that we have identified as part of the initial engagement with these amended provisions. As I said earlier on, as far as the PFMA list, we will recall that the effective date is 1 April, which means that the reports for the year that ended 31 March 2019 are the reports that would have been issued in July of this year. So those 60 instances of material irregularities have been identified among these 16 under the green bar, the PFMA list. A combination of these 16 has triggered about 60 already, which will be the subject of engagement as they already are with the accounting officers. Some accounting officers have already responded to some of the issues that have been raised to them. Some are still within their 20 days because some of those were given to them towards the end of July. So they are still within their 20 days in responding. And therefore, we've had to delay the finalization of some of their reports in respect of these amendments. We have seen through these 16 that there is a concentration of big material irregularities in a few. Some have got 3, some have got 2, some have got 20-something alone material irregularities. Some have got 17, but they shall remain nameless now until we finalize so that I don't have to trigger other things that I'm not going to be able to control. But they will become known once the detail is finalized. But I just want to give you a sense that there's something here that requires much deeper scrutiny at the level of oversight. The year end for local government, which is the red guys, nine of them. You can see all nine of them. There's a municipality for every province, 1-1-1-1-1 for each of the nine provinces. The criteria that we have used, we agreed when we engaged the committee in the Fifth Parliament about it. It was a combination of things that we thought needed to converge in order for us to make the right selections. So in the Eastern Cape, we've only got Nelson Mandela. In Free State, we've got Machabing, and every other province is represented here. These ones, the year ended in June 2019. This is now the current year audit. For local government, it ends in June, and they are required to submit their financial statements by the end of next week because they've got 60 days from the date of the end of the financial year to submit financial statements. So we have not even received the financial statements yet. They are due next week. By the time we report at the end of November, which is 3 months after receipt of financial statements, is it? Yes. 3 months after receipt of financial statements, among these nine municipalities, we will know also the extent of material irregularities that have been identified through the audit. And they will be processed as part of our processing of those reports, and they will surface physically when we report on the MFA audit outcomes in the first half of next year. We will take feedback, Chair, from all of this, because part of this also has had an impact on our people as well. They've had a most terrible experience, some of them, in certain places, because now you're opening people's cupboards where there are things in those cupboards, whereas in the past you used to just paper over the cracks here and walk away. But now you've suddenly opened the cupboards, and it's not nice, based on their experience. So we're starting to look at the feedback that we're getting from the field work just to make sure that our people remain completely or reasonably protected in all instances, because some people tend to be getting a bit rough when you ask certain questions. And sometimes they think that you're asking them the same questions 10 times. They don't realize that you are actually asking about the risk in different ways, even if it's 10 times. So they get a little itchy, and then they want to get physical in some instances. And then they start wanting to accuse you. You have been sent by this, that, and that, and my enemies, and whatnot, and whatnot. So that's the reality. And so I think in doing this phasing in thing, because, I mean, they know that our instruction is to chase the debits and the credits that have been processed in the system. We do not know their friends at the time that you are busy doing this audit, nor do we know. I mean, there are about 3,500 staff members at the AG spread across the whole country. It's unexpected that many of them will know the friends and whoever associated with somebody they are auditing. But that's the game that we're in, and coming with these amended provisions in our Act does bring some level of strain. But we'll share that so that when we then have to roll this out everywhere, at least we know what we are up against and what we're going to deal with, because this has been approved as an amendment to be applied across the board. As you would have seen in the very, very first slides, our mandate is a universal mandate. It does not spare anybody who's publicly funded unless we choose to get those people audited outside of the office. So, Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity. We hope that SCOPA, as it engages with these matters in its oversight work in the Sixth Parliament onwards, we will start to see some shifting of focus, at least, because one of the temptations is that without this instrument at the beginning of an audit, someone somewhere in the institution or department thinks that this is just a statutory audit which will be reported on, goes nowhere, we go to SCOPA, they shout at us, the TVs are there, and then we pick up the headlines on Wednesday morning, and then nothing happens, and then we go back to what we were doing all along, and we come back the following year, we get another knock, and nothing happens. This is going to get somebody to think twice when they now have to process transactions. If they were accustomed to being stopped in the passage while they were traveling to Geneva, and then they get given a huge stack of documents at reception to sign, they will think carefully before they do. Because if they don't, this is saying to them, there's something that's going to come if the audit brings up certain material irregularities. Better be prepared to engage those matters and clear them through the audit, because once they get to this point, the conversation is going to be largely difficult for you to clear if the consequences are going to be applied as they should. But the last point, Chair, for me is it's not going to work, this whole thing of the amendments, for as long as the very required tone at the top in these institutions is not in place. Because the exercise of that diligence on internal controls is a management function. It's not an audit function. So if we can reinvest in that and make sure that everybody applies themselves diligently to this and make sure that that which has to happen is done, maybe they can, others have already said that we can make sure that we do the right stuff all the time and make sure that these provisions are not triggered. There will be places where they are not triggered because people have done the absolute necessary things that are required for financial reporting. Good for us, good for them, less pain. We hope that over time we can graduate and move towards that, because that's the one of the key ingredients we think that could build public confidence in their ability to handle public finances. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, AJ. That's the presentation. That's the presentation. If you take to what the AG has spoken about, it's covered a scope which as well relate to questions that we asked some time. You see, some of those questions are part of the presentation itself. But it's coming back to us, and if we have any comments, questions to ask, here is the AG with his office, and the difference with the earlier presentation is coming up with a legislative environment, and that kind of capacity which is enacted, and the such things that relate to a function which is not coming back to us to say we are not empowered. It says this is where we're going. We're going to act like this because the power now we have. Any comments, any questions, we'll see the whip. Is the H to speak? The Honorable Member Mlenzan, Umama, as well. And then the Chair, would have that. And the Chair this side would as well have a bite. And the Chair, I'm trying to mediate the entirety of interaction. I'm going to start with the whip.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Chair, who audits the AG? But I think we need to commend the AG for the work they've been doing over the years in this country. And, you know, the AG, I was in a municipal environment in previously, in my previous life, as my pride said in his previous life. In my previous life, I was in a municipal environment. And I really appreciate the work that the AG does, you know, because I have first-hand experience. Many people, as you correctly point out, think that the AG comes there to come and investigate them, where the AG is actually trying to assist municipalities to actually perform their functions better and point out to them the shortcomings. So we must commend you and also thank you for the in-depth presentation It was the first time I received such a presentation. It really gave me a better understanding. It was the first time I served on SCOPA. I've never been on SCOPA, so it gives me a better understanding of how the AG performs its functions and all. And I really appreciate it. I'm also happy that the AG now at last will have some bite, because previously we did not have bite. So I'm happy that the AG will have bite now. And the AG must rest assured that this SCOPA, we're going to be 100% behind you. And whatever assistance, whatever role you want us to play, we will do so. We will be with you, we will work with you, we'll cooperate, we'll be 100% behind you. But there's just on your first presentation, I think I missed you on page 9, the trends over the past 10 years. It shows you the trends. And under outstanding audits in 2017-2018, I want to understand, and I'll tell you why, I want to understand what is the reasons for outstanding audits. Is it the outstanding audits due to the fact, as you said, people goes on leave when they must be audited and they don't come, they're not around when you have to audit them, so they miss, you can't audit them. Is that the reason for outstanding audits? Because if that is the reason for outstanding audits, if the reason for outstanding audits is because you were not able to perform those audits due to your capacity with amongst your staff, then it's another story. But if the outstanding audit is due because of people that goes and leave there when they must be audited, when they must give you documentation, then it distorts this graph of yours here, distorts it. Because when you look at 2008-2009, it shows that the disclaimers was 18%. You had 18% disclaimed with findings. But when you look at 2017-2018, you see that disclaimed with findings is 6%. So the point I'm trying to make is that if the outstanding audit is due to municipal officials or whoever don't turn up for audit, that means the disclaimer should actually increase in 2017-2018. I do not know, I missed you there to understand what is the cause of the outstanding audits. But if officials did not come forward when you needed to order them, they should be disclaimed with findings. So that will then change the graph here, where the disclaimed with findings will increase in 2018. Because it shows in 2018 very small 6%, but in 2008 it shows that there was 18% of disclaimed with findings. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Perhaps, AG, let me start by saying don't shy away from boring us with detail. We need the detail. There's this saying that the devil is in the detail. So we need to get deeper into getting the actual devil. Chair, it's two questions, but the first one is multifaceted, such that you may think that there are many questions, but one. Appreciating the stance that the AG is actually taking. I'm looking at the risk of auditors being bribed to produce clean audits. Do we have mechanisms looking at what is it that is likely to come? Also, on your part of the disclaimer, linked, of course, with your page 9, I will not repeat what was raised by the Honorable Whip of the committee on SCOPA.
Don't you normally have a disclaimer due to auditors being refused entry? I'm linking this with what you are saying, that some may run away, but some may literally refuse. Would you not classify that as a disclaimer? Because the bottom line, if I read well, the latter part of your definition of a disclaimer, you are saying we are therefore unable to conclude or express an opinion on the financial statement. That is now the bottom line of the definition of a disclaimer. For whatever reason, why not put that sentence as the bottom line instead of the blue and all the lines? Also linked to this one, Chair, I said it's one question but broad. Honorable Somyo, you are correct that some of the questions and comments were raised before. But now that we are looking at the implementation process, one would like to know what are the financial implications of the expansion of the mandate of the AG. Doesn't this mean now that correctly, as the AG is part of Chapter 9 institutions correctly, if you read in the preamble, it's very clear that here we are dealing with a Chapter 9 institution. But a Chapter 9 institution which is funded, if funded, hence I'm saying funded in inverted commas, its own way, unlike the others. And I would then even, I hear the whip asking who audits. But when you audit what you have allocated, but now, how would we go in audit what we haven't allocated? But as I'm saying, what are now the financial implications of this particular arrangement? The last one, page 13, there you are talking of some of a fruitless and wasteful expenditure written off. Is it page 13? I think so. Yes. Now, what informs the writing off? At what stage do you now decide that let us write off? Is it because there has been explanation or negotiations or what? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson, and I want to take this opportunity in this Women's Month to congratulate the head table and say Malibongi Kamala Madot. She said thank you very much for the presentation, and thank you for the team. I am looking at slide 9 on the slide, the SCOPA members orientation workshop package. And I'm asking myself, and probably you could help us to be able to just say, if you look at the trends over the past 10 years, there seems to have been a movement, Nyana, and then there's a regression with regard to the green bar. And I just wanted to find out from the AG on what needs to be done for this green bar to grow and actually probably misplace the yellow bar and others. The other thing is matters related to the like you indicated, AG, that you would come and make the presentation or give the report, and there's the hullabaloo and there's quiet. The other thing that I've also observed about the reporting of the AG is that, truly speaking, yes, there would be a lot of media coverage and a lot of debates on radios and whatever. But generally, the public does not seem to be able or understand what it is all about. And I think it is this green, yellow, and is it purple or whatever colors that we need to be able to get simplified to people to understand. Because right now there is a perception out there that when the AG's report is presented, it's not those three bullets that the AG was talking to. It is actually what the AG said that report is not dealing with, identifying fraud and probably acts of corruption. And I think that it's because of the lack of information, lack of understanding from our people and the general public, because they need to be able to understand how to read the unqualified with no findings and the qualified with findings, and what difference these reports do have. It will give a different picture for people to understand that. And they would be also the ones that will help government, parliament, and also probably the AG and other institutions to identify where they believe that probably the report might be glossy, because the people in there are clever, they could be able to present and honor the three bullets AG referred to, but in reality there's no delivery. And also be able to, in the opposite, be able to know where there is delivery, but unfortunately the capacity to account for that delivery is lacking. And I think that is one of the areas that we need to try and get from the office of the AG. The use of local languages to simplify the finance language so that people understand truly what we are about. Then the other one, I really appreciate this expanded mandate the AG referred to, and also the issues related to the processes that you indicate what would be followed. But I just wanted to find out the criteria used to determine those 19 areas and the 9 municipalities, because as politicians sitting here, we know in different provinces municipalities that truly would have over and above being followed and to make sure that they account, but be helped by this process to clean up their own act. Because I would believe that out of an audit process, people should actually emerge wiser and a better understanding. In the previous years, in the time I was in the Northern Cape, there used to be a gentleman from the AG in the province at the time, who moved to the Free State. He was telling us about a official from a municipality, and he was sitting there literally like this. He said, "The bloke is untrainable." I never forget that word, because we asked what could be done to help, and he said, "The bloke is untrainable." So some are truly untrainable, unhelpable, even the devil can't do anything with them. Then the issue that is a bit of a concern is the issue of the safety and security of the auditors. Because, I mean, we have seen in the different law enforcement investigations or investigators being killed. And are we saying strengthening the hand of the AG's office would also result in that security challenge? Because if you have, there was an example made in our earlier meeting where there was in a municipality an MM who refused access to MPLs to the municipality. What more about auditors? And it's worrying, because it really means that we're in trouble as a country when we have that type of situation where you are not going to have access and or literally people just not being cooperative. And there needs to be something that even from the side of SCOPA and the different committees that are here, we could be outside from the participation of the AG's office to be able to deliberate on how do we change the mindset of officials that get appointed into these positions for them to understand that that is not your father's, father is even a better place. Your grandmother's house, because in grandmother's house, everybody is welcome. You can't say because every given child is grand Oma second. So thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thanks, Chair. Earlier on, Mom Peters, we really congratulated the AG for his delegation. So, yeah, no, we have considered that one. So, Malibongwe Kamalga AG. Chair, it's just two things. One issue has been raised, and we briefly discussed this in the meeting when we were being briefed on the municipal audit outcomes, and it's been raised now. The issue of the safety of auditors increasingly becoming a problem. Intimidation, harassment, and so on. Obviously, all in the bid to hide, shortcomings. I think in the main, whilst we may agree that there's corruption, but I think the issue of public education on one part, but also the sector education of those being audited is important, because auditing, in my view, is an enabler, sort of witch hunt. And that is where we need to deal with this particular aspect. But why I raise the issue of the security is we had the anti-corruption task team earlier on this morning, as you saw. And we wanted to find out the extent to which you interact and engage with such bodies. Because if we're in a space where we are intimidating auditors, already that's a tell. Already the indication is clear that something there is amiss. And so whether you're receiving the kind of support that you require, because for me, intelligence services need to come on board. We need to be able to detect these things and look there, there's a problem. So when these auditors move into that space, we've cleared the woods insofar as their work is done. So I think we really need to have a discussion about the safety of auditors so that we don't, already a casualty almost, let's not arrive at a fatality about it. So let's deal with it. You know, I am from South Coast KZN, and I'm now part of Durban because of the new demarcations. I was in Ugu, then I woke up, I'm now a metro boy. Very strange. Now, Durban is a point in case where the auditors were, you know, and it's clear now why that happened. If you look at the entire drama playing itself out in a chair, we know, oh, well, that's why the auditors found themselves at the receiving end of harassment when the latest developments come out. So let us, where you need assistance. For me, it's a very serious issue. In Nongoma, for example, one internal auditor, found himself being chased by people and guns and all sorts of funny things in a bid. Now, when that's happening internally, I cannot imagine what happens with the major. So let's see if we can look at that. My second question, clarity-seeking question, is about in Entity A, Hlengwa is the accounting officer, and then I leave, and then Dlamini comes in, and then at the time of the audit, the material irregularity is identified, which happened in my time. Where does the debt note, who does the debt notice go to? So that we can just clarify for us that particular aspect of it. Then there's the, I'm glad, AG, you've clarified the implementation. We had your team last time took us through, and the questions arose in terms of the implementation of your extended mandate. I think what you have explained today in the detail that you have expands on what we were told, and I think it provides the clarity one we needed, but also on the expansion we needed. But the question I think is important for us is the risk of litigation, because you know I get the fact that everybody's got a right to find recourse in a court of law, but there's now recourse for everything. You sneeze, I'm going to court. You sneeze twice, I'm going to court. And the issue then becomes the open-endedness of this. And so whilst the questions may have been clarified, the issue for me is these are costs which are going to escalate. And we just need to, on the issue of the funding of the mandate, I'm particularly looking at the envisaged costs for arising out of this litigation, because generally those who are corrupt like going to court. Finally, Chair, AG, you know, one member has raised something about the clean audits and the buying and so on, and because of sampling. I hope at some other time, maybe not today, we can have a discussion about that particular space, because it's of concern that such an issue will be raised. Chair, an anecdote is that in one place they organized a party and invited a very senior somebody and said, "We are inviting." When he arrives there, "We are celebrating." "What are you celebrating?" "Oh, the 8 years come back and told us that we have qualified." So the breaking down of the terminology as well is important. No, it just qualifying.
Okay, thank you so much, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Let me also welcome the presentation by the AG, and thank the AG for balancing the equation with your representation. I never hear the end of it from Honorable Peters. The AG spoke about people who got licenses in 1978 and others 3 months ago, and he was talking about 1978, he was looking at me. And when I looked around, I saw that at that time representing the species of people who had their licenses some ages ago. I think there was at some stage where the AG would outsource some auditing work to the private firms, especially for the SOCs. Am I correct? Is that still happening? And secondly, I think the AG has said, obviously they don't audit the question of, let me say, the impact, for instance, the socioeconomic impact of what we are spending money to. And those of us who are coming from the Appropriations Committee, that becomes our major focus. The question perhaps I would like to know, who does that? The AG doesn't do it. Who does that? Because we think that's a very important thing to know, the impact of the money is that, for instance, we are appropriate from Parliament. Do you audit the performance of boards of the SOCs? I'm consider other things, but the boards, I'm sure you'll appreciate why I'm asking that question. I would like to hear the relationship and between the AG and the internal audit function. especially to deal with the gap, which you say sometimes because of what you deal with, the samples and so on that you take as you audit, that you can't audit everything. What's the relationship and how would you characterize the performance of internal audit both in government and SOCs. Actually, can you say something about matters of emphasis, the weight that you give to that, and the appreciation, for instance, of the organizations that you audit when it comes to that? I think those would be my questions, but thank you very much.
Well, actually, those are a couple of questions and comments, which are coming up as part of the scope, which seek to further strengthen the understanding of what the office is doing, and at the same time, to appreciate the fact that you must conduct such work unhindered in some instances. We are functioning within the ambits of a constitutional state, and therefore there will be some kind of a movement to the recipients of such reports to seek to venture into litigatory instances to test the outcomes in a way. With the Office of the Auditor General, which through its own funding, I think someone asked that is mainly dependent on the pricing of your audit work and therefore auditees to accommodate that kind of scope to their own payment. From the environment of finance and treasury, there would be a cry at the municipal level, specifically, of the exorbitant pricing of such a kind of work, such that the Office of the Auditor General might, while incurred costs, would be very difficult to get back in terms of such payment. So that the impairments are going to be a bit huge when it comes to that instance. I know for a fact that this Sixth Parliament is beginning a process of evaluating its sort of contribution into the Auditor General's work, and the Office of the Speaker has started a process which sought to venture into that mechanism. As to how far it will go is going to be determined by a resource base as well going forward. But you can't shy away from the fact that you are going to definitely face litigations which are going to sought some kind of review. If at this rate there is a lot of violent behavior meted against the Auditor General's staff, which is a bit not smart in terms of attending to such dissatisfaction. There are as well smart ways. It might as well, if you really want to see the office succeeding in some of those angles, while new arrivals you see here, and the litmus paper testing of the new legislation and its own regulations ought to determine the level of success, even in terms of such processes that are going to be undertaken by the Auditor General in terms of the steps to effect those mandatory outcomes or instances of the findings going forward. There is something which I saw a bit interesting. I'll make this example that the courts or the comments in terms of the public protector, they would say you are venturing. Your primary responsibility is not necessarily on the criminal element you see, of what is creeping in. So you can't investigate this and that and that and that, and therefore it's not your role. The Act says do A, B, C, D, E. So you can't do this. You see, whatever you find, but that's not your responsibility. You know, the AG is saying to us, there were only three steps of the AG's involvement. And the fourth one, which is now becomes mandatory, is looking into the materiality of irregularity. You know, and it could be dealt with in terms of enforcement, you know, which has come later through the amendment. So that then is coming up with various levels of irregularity, and some of them would lead to fraud, steep corruption, and unfortunately, the office of the AG is capacitated in terms of accountants, this and that. There is, in terms of enforcement, you are not building jails. Someone else must take that responsibility going forward. So even if you like it in terms of speed, the pile of what is happening in terms of the cases referred to various institutions is going to impact on the capability of the Office of the Auditor General. How to avert such going forward, which is one of the luxuries of those who break the law in as far as corruption is concerned. And then the last area from my side is the fact that when we got into the Auditor General's committee, there was one area, I think you have referred to it, the ESCOM, as an example of the institutions which you don't audit. You know, though you have indicated to us that the Constitution has got an instructive section that you must audit. You must audit such entities in a way. And in this instance, you are only getting in to deal with certain other elements handled somewhere else. For certification, therefore, you know, is there no role that you could play to certify such audits or the steps in terms of the audit? I know for a fact that at some stage I was involved in one of the institutions of higher learning, playing a role in the audit committee, where we found out that the Office of the Auditor at that time had nothing to do with the audits in such universities. Up until there was some takeover, which itself came gradually in a way. In this instance, you know, there was some improvement even into the level of accountability on the public funds and accounts. And don't you think that has got something to do with the fact that look into the very big institutions of audit, which have indicatively shown some failure out there in terms of the accountability of some of these institutions. Don't you think the level of your absence into such entities has got to do with some form of laxity in terms of accountability around these matters? The case in point, you would take liberty to see how KPMGs and of this world have performed, and other very big audit institutions have performed, and the step by step into when there is such big allocations. Take ESCOM now. The country had to be in standstill, and there had to be a special bill which ought to be prioritized by Parliament, which goes into billions of rands, and there is no fitted, accountability that relates to the work of the Office of the Auditor General when it comes to such books being somewhat assessed in a way. So is there no linkage on the laxity around such areas?
So I think let me just take my own questions through those areas. Back to you, Auditor General.
Thanks very much. Part of what I'm going to do also is to just make sure that the members understand that the people here next to me have got something to do with many of these questions. So they didn't come here for nothing. So that as we get the compliment now in August, we can also give substance to it right now. So it's going to happen right now. So Alice, you're going to deal with the issue of safety and security of auditors because you have worked with this from when it all started. Linda, there was a question relating to the criteria for determining those that we picked up. So can you please help with that? Marisa, the matters pertaining to the litigious environment in which we operate. I think let's start with those ones while I figure out what the answers are to the rest of the other questions. So shall we start with Marisa?
Another word is on leave.
Yes.
What do we have to talk about? The audit.
Fortunately. Oh yeah, no, fortunately the targets are still here. So if you can start, Marisa, then I'm going to try and see whether I know the rest of what needs to be said.
Thank you very much, Chair, members, and the AG. This actually, AG, I can give you a little bit more time to figure out the answers to other questions by taking two of the questions that the members asked. There was a question about who should take a certificate of debt in the case of accounting officers resigning. And I think this is a very important question that we unpack properly, and I'll try to do that very quickly because during the drafting process of this Act, it came up time and time again in all the forums that we spoke about it. It is a matter where you will see that the moment the environment gets a little bit pressurized, an accounting officer will see that this is going to become a personal liability for me, so let me rather leave. And the question that was posed to us is, but what happens if this accounting officer leaves? Who gets that certificate of debt? Would that be the guy who left, or that will be the acting accounting officer or a new accounting officer? So the long and the short of this answer is that this is administrative justice. So we need to make sure that the process that we follow is fair, reasonable, and rational. So you cannot issue a certificate of debt against an accounting officer who, firstly, did not have the powers to enforce a recommendation or remedial action by the AG, and secondly, who did not have a reasonable opportunity in terms of time to do that. So how it will work out in practice is that it will depend on what phase of the material irregularity process you find yourself in when this accounting officer resigns. If you can prove that this accounting officer left after, let's say, remedial action has been issued, that's far down the line already. So he or she must have had a reasonable opportunity to implement the recommendations and the remedial action of the AG. That certificate of debt will follow the individual. Doesn't matter whether he or she still sits in the position. Like our former chairperson said, as long as you breathe, accounting officer, we will find you. This is the way the certificate of debt will follow you, provided that you've had the powers to implement and that you have had a reasonable opportunity to do so. Then there was also the question about the litigious environment that we find ourselves in. I think it is important to also just clarify that the Auditor General has been in a litigious space for a number of years already. It's not only as a result of the new powers that we now attracted into the law. So you will find that accounting officers do not always agree with your audit outcomes, and they do take the audit reports on review for various reasons, whether it's simply disagreement or whether they actually have further motives to that, be that as a delay of a particular audit, etc. We are very aware of that, and we've recently drafted a brand new litigation strategy and policy that goes with it. In an attempt to curb the litigious pressures that we have, we do foresee, obviously, that these new enforcement powers will come off probably with an increased level of litigation against the AG. But we've now packaged a proactive plan on how to use established relationships and specifically platforms of dispute resolution, where we will first try to mitigate these resolutions or disputes before they actually go to court. So the policy is going to be implemented soon, so we will have to apply and see how productive that is. But we have, in worst-case scenario, also increased the funds being made available for matters that are taken on review to the High Court. So we believe at this stage that we are properly prepared for it. We have not seen, fortunately, in the 16 that we've implemented the MI process right now, there hasn't been a single litigious matter emanating from it. Doesn't matter, it doesn't mean that it's not going to happen, but so far so good. I just thank you.
Thanks, Aisha. Just to outdo Marissa a bit, I'm also going to take two more questions extra. I think the first one that we talked about is the criteria for how did we decide on these. In the end, it worked out 25 auditees for our phased in. And on our slides, the one on the PIA mandate on page 23, it talks about our selection criteria. So for this first year, what we wanted to do is to choose the auditees where we do think we will have the biggest impact, and we also wanted to make our decision based on information that is available in the public domain. So you see, we looked at the outcomes of these auditees, and then also we looked at who's been having consistently the highest irregular expenditure over the past 3 years. And that mostly actually informed our decision on which auditees to choose. That's why you would probably see a lot more metros chosen as part of the MFMA list in our smaller municipalities, because our focus was really where's the biggest irregular expenditure. I would also like to address the question around the outstanding audits. There was a question about what is the reason for these outstanding audits. Is it that the teams are being chased away? Does it mean it could be disclaimers of opinion? And if you look at on that slide, it indicates that there's quite a number of outstanding audits, and most of them was on the local government level. And with those ones, the vast majority is literally municipalities that cannot produce financial statements. Either they produced it late, and then for some of them, we still don't have the financial statements of the previous year. We don't express a disclaimer of opinion until we actually finally received the financial statements, and often these financial statements, when we receive it, it's also actually not very well put together financial statements. There are a few of our municipalities where the audits are late. Some of them are actually because of protest actions at the municipality, or where we found a very difficult environment to audit, and maybe Alice will also touch on that very quickly. But there has been an increasing number of outstanding audits at the end of each of our cycles that we are seeing at this stage. And then I just wanted there was a question around fruitless and wasteful expenditure and when is it being written off. And it is actually a process that each auditee, department or municipality needs to go through, where they would investigate where this money, this fruitless and wasteful expenditure, how did it happen, who caused it, and is it possible to still recover that money from somewhere. And if it's written off, it should be based on quite a detailed process that they went through, where they concluded it is impossible to get this money back from anybody, whether it is from an official or from a supplier or any other third party. And that's the only time that they are actually allowed to write off.
Thank you, Chair. I'll deal quickly with the staff matters. On the issue around safety and security of our staff, we're taking this matter extremely serious. So we started a project where we have a task team that look after this area. And with the help of the law enforcement agencies, we put together a security awareness program for our staff. We started with the basics. Where do you park your car when you're at an order T? Do you make sure that the security cameras are working, etc.? So it was a basic awareness of security that we started with our staff. Maybe I must also add that a lot of these areas where we found where our staff find it difficult to work in is as a result of the environment. During MFMA, there's quite a high number of protest actions, where the team then either get caught in the municipality, they can't get out, or when they get to the municipality, there's a protest and they need to return to their guest house, etc. So those matters affect. Those are not targeted directly because there's Auditor General staff at the premises. But what we have done as well in terms of proactive steps is we have engaged the law enforcement agencies, specifically the South African Police Service. And what we did is to create a relationship between our business executives in the provinces and the provincial commissioners of police. So there's a close relationship between them. When the teams go out to the municipalities, the senior manager has been tasked to meet with the station commander in every jurisdiction and create a visible policing effort. So the police will come by the offices once or twice a week, just making sure that there's visible policing, that people know we are there and the police are around. If there's an instance of a threat or intimidation, we act immediately. We withdrew our teams immediately. And then depending on the assessment, again, we involve the law enforcement agencies to help us to do an assessment. We will then determine whether teams are able to go back to the municipality or the auditee to finalize the audit, or will the audit be finalized from a provincial office. During the last MFMA round, there were a number of audits that were finalized from our offices, where the books and the documents had to be brought to our offices to audit, because it was just unsafe at the auditee to remain there. There was also a number of instances where we called on the law enforcement agencies to assist us to do that assessment whether it's safe to go into any specific area, and they've been very responsive to assist us in that regard. Maybe I must also just indicate there was another question around the ethics, which is looking at the internal part to say that does our staff honour the commitment to ethics, and what's the risk we're facing. As a leadership in the organisation, we take a no tolerance to ethic failures as a serious matter. So we've tightened our ethics policy. We've driven awareness around ethics. We've got a whistleblowing tool internally to make sure that when there's an ethical breach, we act on it immediately. So I think if I look at the risk that we face it both internally, externally, and on both those we have acted to make sure that we do what we can to prevent it from happening. We've also indicated to our teams that they, maybe just to go back to the external threat, that they don't take risks. If at any stage they feel unsafe, they need to raise the red flag and return to the offices. We're not going to put our staff in any jeopardy when it comes to their safety. Thank you, AG.
Right. Thanks very much. Chair, let me now try and manage the remaining questions, because they also leave me a bit confused by taking other things that I wanted to deal with. Let's start with Honorable Dix. We get audited by external private audit firms, but there are not too many of them that qualify to audit us. Reason being that the Public Audit Act, firstly, requires that we must also present our own books for audit. The challenge and the difficulty that we have is that we do not have the luxury of choice. Because in the South African environment, the majority of the private audit firms, ranging from the ones that often get spoken about, the big four, Deloitte, PwC, and all of them, then you go down the chain to the middle size, and you further go into the smaller ones. The majority of them do not have, shall I call it, the commercial appetite to audit us as our statutory auditors. And the reason is largely, as I say, commercial appetite is largely financial, in the sense that, maybe linking it to the question Honorable Buthelezi has raised, we dish out work on an outsourced basis. And the people that do the work for us on an outsourced basis are barred from raising their hand to audit us, because then there will be a conflict of interest. While they are auditing on our behalf, they cannot audit our own books. So we end up with a small pool from which to choose our statutory auditor. Part of the mitigation of that risk is that our audit committee, which is made up of independent members outside of the office, who themselves, some of them, for example, the chair of our audit committee, is a retired partner from one of the audit firms. Some of the members of our committee are people with specialist knowledge of different things, but working in the South African economy. Nothing to do with us in terms of employment. So they are independent. So whenever the term of a statutory auditor comes up for renewal, the independent audit committee handles that process. And when they've handled it, they will submit their recommendations to the Standing Committee on the AG, SCOWEC, for the SCOWEC to process what they are recommending. So we do have a statutory auditor, although it is limited, because think about it, our fee for the audit of our books, let's for argument's sake say it will be about 3 million. But the opportunity that that firm forgoes by not bidding for contract work could be somewhere in the region of 15 to 20 or even more in terms of amount. So when you weigh the options as a firm, you start saying to yourself, maybe let me not raise my hand to audit the AG because I'm going to get very little for it, while there's a lucrative opportunity to audit on behalf of them. And so that's how we get audited. So those three bullets, we've passed them every year, the ones I spoke about regarding how you get to a clean audit. We've always passed them because if we didn't, it could be a serious nightmare. Then the license to operate from our side would be gone. We can't speak about others' performance when our own has been found wanting. So we've been lucky to make sure that we keep the level of rigor and the transparency of our transactions at the right level. So we've always gotten, you'll see in our annual report, even the last year one, when you read it, effectively an independent auditor that has scrutinized our accounts. So that's the situation with regards to that. Then Alice has dealt with the, or rather Linda has dealt with the issue of the outstanding audits. Let me say that when you look at that red bar of disclaimers in the early years, and you look at how it comes down, as well as how the clean audits start to become bigger. Part of that was the impact of the effort, even though it was limited, around what was referred to, you'll remember, Operation Clean Audit 2014. And you see in this 10-year graph, suddenly things tend to change to the positive side around 2014, 15, 15, 16. And people put the foot off the accelerator soon thereafter, after some had achieved that clean audit. That's why you're seeing a ballooning of the green, a declining of the disclaimer. And SALGA, in terms of municipalities, was very instrumental in incorporating, as well as in the national and provincial departments, in the MTSF targets for achieving good outcomes and eliminating disclaimers. And some people were incentivized for that, to say that if you eliminate the disclaimer and you improve your audit outcome, there will be an incentive. And that's what you see there. But subsequent to those years, others started saying, rather than get a negative opinion, I'm holding back the accounts, and hence you see the ballooning of those outstanding audits. So it's largely behavioral, not necessarily the illness of people most times, but part of that is just the behavioral part, where they just never come forth for scrutiny because they think that the audit outcome is not worth what it really will be. Now, the issue about the... Maybe let me reinforce part of what's been answered in terms of the bribery to produce clean audits. I think the question was raised by Honorable Mlenzane. That part is always a nightmare of a possibility for any auditor, because we send people to go and do field work. We are not in full control of the arrangements that they are entering into, if ever. But what we do know is a lot of them, because they have signed up as chartered accountants who are leading those teams, they know that the risk of doing that doesn't just sit with us as an institution. It also sits with them. They must make a choice at the age of 28, 29, 30, whether the code of professional conduct that they signed up to, in regards to them becoming chartered accountants by training, which gives them the license to operate as chartered accountants for the next 30 to 40 years of their lives. They've got to make a choice. And we tell them, when we get into engagements on issues of ethics, that this is what we expect of you, but you have to make a choice for that license to be withdrawn from you, and you'll just become an ordinary person and an ordinary accountant, should we find that out. Some that ventured into some silly activity where they would not disclose certain commercial transactions. For example, somebody comes from somewhere else and they apply for a job, and they were in their own mind an entrepreneur. And some of them, entrepreneurship is about, say, distributing learning materials. Maybe they came from a particular province and they got entrepreneurial. We say to them, disclose that and get out of it. Because should you be assigned an audit in education, you will find yourself conflicted, because you are also, you know, parachuting business activity in that environment. So there's a huge conversation that we have internally, which is not only limited to declarations that must be made every year, but it's also part of that proactive advocacy. So many know that the risk goes both ways. If anything like that happens, we will be found wanting. But remember, your license to operate for the rest of your life, for the next 30 years, is also at risk, because you can never be trusted now as a chartered accountant once you have fallen foul of the code of professional conduct. So it's largely the advocacy part, quite frankly. There's nothing else we can do to stop it, but for as long as they are aware and they know that they need to act in a particular way, then at least they know that they are protecting their own bread and butter, because other than that, there's a big risk for them. And again, there's also a peer group issue around this matter, because we no longer have CAs in small number. We have them in large numbers now. So it's a community of people who normally converge towards understanding the real implications of this. And so far, we haven't come across those kind of difficulties. But we can never sit back and say they will never happen. The fact that they know there's a risk, we also need to continue to raise the bar to make sure that as part of the change management intervention for these amendments, that is part of the central conversation. For example, when we were looking at the implications of the implementation of these amendments, we pulled in the entire senior management team to engage on these matters. And fortunately, a lot of the questions around those matters came from the senior management team themselves, about 290 of us in the office in that category of senior management and above. And there was a frank conversation about these matters, and I think we are building up on it to say, be aware that it's not just the risk of safety and security, but it's a risk of somebody diverting your attention from that which you live by to try and take shortcuts because you're going to get some lucrative benefit of one kind or another. So we are alive to that. Refusing entry to auditors, certainly that is something we have not really experienced that much, not being allowed to get into a particular audit environment, but some of them is normally circumstantial, where there's a, as Alice said, there's a protest on that particular day. Then you can't, like other people who cannot. So, but at least we know that there are other ways to get access to the audit evidence if we are not able to do it online. Let me speak quickly to the financial implications of the expansion of the mandate. When we made a submission for these amendments, we also tagged along a memorandum for what we believe the financial implications are going to be. We quantified it more at a high level and said, when we do the referrals, it's going to cost money. So we've already made a submission, and we hope that when we trigger the next level of engagement, we will try and access that appropriation. It's not a huge amount. I think we largely put it to somewhere around close to 34 million, to say this is what we think it will take to establish a unit that is going to manage these material irregularity processes, because the different business units, all nine provinces, as well as all the seven business units nationally, are going to need some level of support and coordination, legal, forensic, accounting, technical interpretation of matters, and all of that. So we do need some resource to establish that unit. So it's a once-off appropriation that we had proposed, and we are working with National Treasury to work around how to get access to it. Once we establish this unit, even though the responsibility and the additional requirements of these amendments look like they attract a lot of money, the other part of it was to say, let us all be diligent in pursuing the risk approach to the audit. Because the auditors themselves do not necessarily need to spend huge, if an audit, for example, takes 2,000 hours, this extra effort may just be a small percentage of those 2,000 hours as an additional effort. Some of it we can absorb with the existing resources. Some of it we might need to expand the team by one or two individuals to be able to navigate the full environment. Because if it's a risk-based audit, we still do risk assessment on audits, but most of the things that we came across, we didn't have to do much about. But within the 2 or 3 months that we do the audit, we believe that we are able to factor some of those. But if it becomes clear that there's additional big resources required, we'll definitely raise our hand. But for now, we are working on a basis that it is possible to absorb these matters in certain instances, but where it becomes unmanageable, that's when we will raise the flag. But there are definitely some implications, but not to the extent that we must expand the teams, double the size of what we have. No, no, no. Not even 50% of the size, because it's part of the risk universe that we navigate in audits, and it's a question of how rigorous do we get. And alongside, we begin to expand the level of training, because an auditor is an auditor, like other auditors, where they are chasing fair presentation issues. But in our establishment, we do have an investigations business unit that is staffed with people that have got forensic training. There's a difference between a normal statutory auditor and a statutory auditor who's got some forensic insights. Because as they are looking at an invoice, they are thinking about other things from a forensic point of view that they need to take into account. And that's how you get quickly to a material irregularity without employing a new person. So part of it is the empowering through our investigations business unit and additional training to say, you were used to just looking at an invoice and seeing the invoice was for, let's say, 50,000. The date is the date in the period. The entity is the entity you are auditing. But think about it again. If you are looking at an invoice and the invoice is written on a Croxley Cambric, that book you buy from CNA, which has got pages from 1 to 50, and it's got the perforation, you know, and this person who has issued this invoice from the entity was awarded a 120 million contract. Think twice about the invoice you saw, even though the amount is right. Right? That's the forensic attitude towards auditing, towards getting to matters of material irregularity. Because how come does an entity that is writing an invoice on a Croxley invoice from CNA get awarded a contract of that amount? Because one of the things that it means is that they do not have an accounting system on which they can be relied upon by the person who's buying services from them. It is that level of enhancement that we are also building into it so that we don't bombard the system with huge numbers when we can actually be smarter about getting to that rigor that comes with this additional material irregularity consideration. What can be done with regards to getting accounting officers and to make sure that they continue, or rather they do what they need to do? What I'm thinking of here is that accounting officers have got these additional responsibilities, or rather these responsibilities that are in the respective sections of the Act. And I think that in line with these amendments, some level of support to them as they carry out their duties might be required. Because they are not always in the wrong. Sometimes they do things because someone has enforced it upon them to happen that way. Think about the example of that old Soren case. So they normally say when we engage them on these amendments, the accounting officers, they said, well, AG, we understand where you come from. However, the PFMA gives us these responsibilities. But the Public Service Act gives the same responsibilities to somebody else to whom we report. So then there's a fight now about who's responsible for doing what when we have to insist on certain things being done a particular way. And then you discover that, no, but the Public Service Act requires something, somebody else who's got the power and who can override you as an accounting officer. So they say, well, we understand the logic of this, but our hands are tied because we get overridden because another act on the same system suggests that I'm not the one in charge, is the person to whom I report. And I think the reconciliation between the two in respect of aligning those responsibilities is possibly the level of support and protection that might be brought to bear to accounting officers. Then at least if they have that, then they may have little excuse to say we cannot do the things that are expected of us in legislation. The public understanding of our outcomes and simplification thereof, you'll be pleased, Honorable Peters, to know that part of what we've embarked on, particularly in the local government side of things, was to partner with some social audit entities. For example, in Eguruleni, they've got some of these social audits, and I see some of them are expanding in other regions as well, where the local communities in that area are very actively involved in things like the delivery of sanitation infrastructure in their areas. They know what is expected to be delivered because they speak and sit with ward councillors. And what we've agreed with them was that we're going to learn from them because they've got the insights about the detail of what they do on the ground, whereas we pick up risks in the higher level environment in the municipality. And what we had committed to do with them, and we've already started in Gauteng when they started doing it in Ekurhuleni, is to bring them forth share with them what our outcomes mean, and so that they can share with us their experiences of whether this sanitation infrastructure that was being delivered has been delivered. Part of some innovative work they've done was also to be part of supervising how the supply chain processes happen in their local areas, which is a good thing because they see on the boards who the contractor is for the particular contract. And they are the ones who go there first to make inquiries at the municipality. Again, we said once we finish our audit work, we'll come to them and say to them, these are the kind of things that we have picked up in the municipality. Do they resonate with the experiences that they've had as part of the social audit? And we hope that that will largely over time deal with the issue of the public understanding. But also at a higher level, I agree that communication as well as the issue of language is quite important to demystify the meaning of these audits. The criteria thing has been answered. Now, the issue of the drilling down to instances of corruption, it might help if we've got key teams that go into the depth of the material irregularities, because that's where you will find fiddling with the finances as well. ACTT interactions. We've met with many of the colleagues that were here this morning in the period towards preparing for the implementation of the Public Audit Act. I know that we have had engagements with the SIU. We have had engagements with the NDPP. We've had engagements with the Public Service Commission. We've interacted with quite a number of them, just to sensitize them to the fact that we're going to be relying on them, including the public protector. We're going to be relying on them in terms of the referral mechanism, and we're going to be interfacing with them on an ongoing basis to make sure that our work does not disappear, because many of them have got mandates that are more focused on these matters than ours is. And of course, in addition to that, the SAPS, when our people are troubled in these environments, we were given a line into the minister in addition to the provincial commissioners. We also have a line directly to the Speaker of the National Assembly whenever those matters come up, but also the ministerial portfolios that are responsible for the areas that we audit, the likes of COCTA, for example, when former Minister of COCTA was still in that role when the Etekwini matter came up. He was very critical in assembling all of those players who have got constitutional responsibilities, and there were exchanges of correspondence between those key players to make sure that whoever is responsible for this down there, other constitutional structures were triggered into action to make sure that they direct their message towards the right thing. As a result, it was not too long before our teams were actually given the authority to go back and actually scrutinize those particular documents. So we've triggered it at a micro level, but at a macro level, we've also got levels of engagement. And I think we will continue to exercise that responsibility without exposing the practical tools that we have at our disposal to mitigate this. Let me say, Chair, also that if, in respect to the matter of litigation, just to close it out, if somebody has made off with 100 million and they know that there's little consequence for this, sometimes to protect that 100 million, they are happy to spend 10 in litigation, because in any case it was ill-gotten gains, including that 10. So I think that's the other part of this whole thing of litigation. We can do what we do here, but the practical reality is that if I've got 100 million, I don't mind spending 10 to protect it, with all the senior counsel I can find in the world to come and make ease look like was, all of those type of things and so on. So I think that's part of the other reality of this litigious environment that we cannot do much about, because it depends on the assessment of the people assessing the matter in a court situation. Our funding, we made a choice that, and of course we were advised way back in 2009, I think, when we reviewed our funding model, and some members of our standing committee way back then, I think in the fourth or whatever, yeah, fourth parliament. We are of the view that is it not about time that we must review our funding model in making sure that we are sustainably properly funded? And the options were put on the table when we reviewed it. Part of it was to say, well, why don't you get an appropriation like others so that you don't have to worry about invoicing? So the good counsel that we got after we presented the different options was that stay with the billing option. Because with the billing option, the only challenge you have is the recovery of the money after you've invoiced. If you are going to opt for a full appropriation, because we do have a combination of billing and appropriation in our act. It's allowed, but it's never been exercised because we've gone the route of billing. If you go the route of an appropriation, then you must be prepared to stand in the queue with others that have submitted their very convincing motivations on the side of the executive in this case. And you'll probably be last in the queue when the determination of who gets what is made. So it's risky, that one, if you compare it to the billing. Because the billing, you go in and you issue an engagement letter, there's a quantifiable set of hours, there's a rate that is known, it's been budgeted by the entity that's already received the resources, the chances are that you will get it through that mechanism. But if you come here and the priorities change, and now we need to sort out health, we must sort out other things and infrastructure and so on, you might find yourself right at the back of the queue. And you are not at the high table when the decision is made about who gets what. So we kind of followed that counsel and said, well, maybe it's best to stay where we are and navigate the environment by increasing our rigor with regards to collections. So collections have been a trouble for various reasons, but we've made an effort over the years to try and minimize the extent to which we do not recover the fee. But we've also taken certain steps, Chair, just to get back to your point regarding the scope of work. We've interacted through this amendment process with National Treasury as well, whereby we say there are many municipalities that are small in size, but get subjected to the same standards like others, but they don't have really an economic base from which to engage, to raise the money that they can use to afford to pay our fees. So we've got an arrangement that will trigger this year where we say, what is the scope and the extent of risk that needs to be addressed in that particular category of municipalities? And we make a determination with National Treasury as to the extent of work that is required to be done there. And we sort out that particular excess fee directly with the National Treasury by accessing it via or directly through the National Revenue Fund. So that has been finally agreed and signed off by the Minister of Finance when this amendment was processed, so that we don't worry those municipalities with the issue of audit fees that might escalate because they have to adhere to the same standard of auditing that we do. National Treasury will advise us and say, there's not even a budget going. Those people are just looking after maintenance of existing things. You don't have to bother giving them the same opinion. Let's agree on a scope of work that you need to do at a minimum so that they don't think they are off the hook. Because once people know they are not being audited, then they do all sorts of things. You must always know that you're going to audit them, but they don't know how and what extent you are going to. So we've got that arrangement in place, which we hope will assist in terms of this. And lastly, the question you raised regarding whether we would certify the audits that are done through the Section 4.3 mechanism. It is not allowed for another auditor to certify the work that was done by another auditor, because that auditor who did the work, in coming to a conclusion, they must take into account the work they've done right from planning to execution to evaluation and concluding on the audit evidence. Then they must sign off their audit report themselves. All we do in this instance, Chair, as you have alluded to earlier, was that we go to the audit committee meetings so that we can have an understanding of what are the risks that are being addressed in that environment. But also, universities, for example, as an example of this, when the Higher Education Amendment Act was processed, if you remember, part of the things that they pushed back on was issues of university autonomy in taking decisions about matters also pertaining to who appoints their auditors. So some of them kicked back and said they want to maintain the status quo. Otherwise, if someone else decides who must audit them, then they will lose the autonomy that they jealously guard as universities, among others. So we really didn't go far, but many of the TVET colleges are part of our portfolio of audits that we do. So, and perhaps the issue about the private audit firms, we engage them directly now on this, Chair, and some of them have got cold feet ever since there have been so many publicly reported scandals. Some of them are open. They say their risk management in their firms have been enhanced to the extent that they are discouraged even by their international firms to take on public sector work, because the public sector work has become very tricky for them, because 98% or so of their work is in the private sector. They have not had enough time to expose their people to the nitty-gritties and the real nub of the risks in the public sector, whereas that's our bread and butter. They prefer to stay out of it, and gradually many are shifting away from doing this kind of work. You know, for example, if you look at the statutory auditors that responded to a public invitation for auditors of ESCOM, there were few and far between, the ones that responded. And it's a question of risk appetite, because once somebody audits a particular entity and they get slapped with a huge insurance, or rather not insurance, but a claim on how they missed A, B, and C, and they think that there's a huge concentration of those things that they can miss this side of the equator. So that's the area where we are now. So we're hoping that at least it's not going to put in an extraordinary pressure on us where people want us to take this work back. Because some of them, they encourage us to try and take back some of these audits. Some of them are big. And some of these big and entities, they are difficult to take on, firstly. But secondly, they are difficult to stabilize. Because it's not like others think, you've got a long checklist and then you stand there like a factory manager in distribution, and then you've got a piece of paper and then you tick, 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 tick until the day is over. There's a huge, I mean, when you go to Medupi and Kusile, you're going to see some of these big concrete things. They were not delivered by a truck. There was cement and bricks that came and other things that are sitting there as big steel mounted into the ground. You won't even see some of it, but it's complete product. Auditors are required to navigate how the costings of those things have happened when they audit. And they are complex because engineers have got another logic in how they put these things together, while accountants are chasing a different way of thinking about them. So, enough for the day.
Well, thank you very much, Chair. From my side, Chair, thank you very much for the presentation and the responses. But it as well highlights the growth in terms of accountability processes and the magnitude of difficulties which it goes with it, and how the institutions must begin to solidify their own capability. So, the chair of the session, thank you very much, AG, for that presentation. The indication, Chair, is that we have been given some sort of a recipe to begin to build on when we get deeper into the work, you see, of the term. It's like was over the firm ground of a understanding. And on your behalf and the committee, we as well appreciate that we have been joined by our colleagues. We think that we have sort of a benefit out of these kinds of interaction. AG, Mr. Benzoko Mkulu, you see around these instances. The committees, I hear, to assist you with that commitment from our side. We're working towards a similar angle of success, accountability. Over to you, Chair.
Thank you. you very much, Chair. Colleagues, just one announcement about tomorrow. We are meeting at 9 o'clock to meet with National Treasury. And then we will start with the SIU at 20 past 12, then a committee meeting tomorrow at 2. And hopefully we will finish earlier. So if we can all be here at 9 o'clock, we'll start, as I say, with National Treasury. From